first to the party and last to leave. What do you say we party together? This is Sportsnet Today. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sunday morning, everybody. I'm Roger Lejoie. This is Sportsnet Today and the Sportsnet Radio Network. And great to be with you on this beautiful Sunday morning. Reach the show on Twitter. Find me at TheRog590, at Fan590. You can email Roger at Sportsnet590.ca and text the show 590-590. Name and location if you are texting, please. Great to be with you. David Alter is going to join us in about 5-10 minutes. He's a Maple Leafs reporter at the Hockey News. And we'll talk lots of NHL, NBA, Blue Jays, the usual. Blue Jays, the big topic of the show today, as they should be. The Friday night game, boy, it is hard. It's hard not to even get emotional just recapping it, that entire presentation. And by the way, kudos to the Blue Jays organization for the job they have done in the last couple of years. I don't want to get overly dramatic, say keeping the franchise afloat, but my goodness, from March 2020, getting the news in spring training, as we all did, what is going on, and back to Toronto, or back, you know, back home, basically, players going back home. Then, of course, they play the season in Dunedin, a quasi-bubble, whatever that was. Then the Buffalo, now to Toronto, 22 months between home games, and they put on a dignified and terrific presentation on Friday night to welcome people home. I thought nothing but outstanding. It was nothing but outstanding. For people there, watch on TV, most of us did, absolutely tremendous. And I've been the official score of a lot of great moments at Rogers Center in the last 10 years. And I've been in that ballpark since it was built. And I don't recall a better night. And I don't recall ever being more grateful and appreciative of seeing a baseball game. And if that's what comes out of this COVID debacle, well, then maybe we all learned a lesson. So congratulations to them. My question on Twitter today, though, isn't so much about the emotion of the Blue Jays, although you want to weigh in if you're at the ballpark, your thoughts and you're watching, I'd love to hear from you. That's a great thing to text in. 590-590, give us your name and your location. What were your feelings on Friday night? What did you think? And yesterday as well, this return after all this prolonged period of time. But the subject of the poll on Twitter today revolves around the actual on-field performance of this team. And the trade deadline, they tried to do a ton of things, and they did a few big things, and they are much improved. And the fact that they're back in Toronto, made the adjustments at the trade deadline, returning to health, let's not forget that. Like, you know, starting to Alex Manoah, how big is it that he's back and pitching? My goodness, he was good yesterday. 2 hours and 19 minutes. You kidding me? He pitches like Mark Burley does, like he has dinner reservations. I love the guy. Just over and over. Beautiful stuff. So the question's a simple yes or no today. We'll make it nice and simple. Are they going to make the playoffs? Yes or no? No maybes, no choices. I'm saying yes. They've dug too deep a hole, probably, to catch Boston, because that's really, really asking for some, and perhaps even Tampa Bay. But I expect the Blue Jays to win enough ball games down the stretch to make the playoffs. I really do. And once you're in the playoffs and in the wild card game, as we all know, anything can happen. This club is going to be scary good in a very short order. So that is our big topic, of course, of the day. We will also keep an eye on the Olympics. Andre Degrasse getting the bronze medal for Canada. About time a guy won a medal in the Olympics, eh? It's getting a little embarrassing for... I got a female friends keep telling me, yeah, it's 13-0 now. Yeah, well, we got a bronze. About time, Andre. Holy smokes. I was a little disappointed, to tell you the truth, though, because he won the qualifying and had the best time heading into the qualifying. However, it shows you it's the Olympics, but that's a fantastic accomplishment. Back-to-back bronze medals in consecutive Olympics. So congratulations to Andre DeGrasse and Canada up to 14 medals. We'll keep an eye on that as well. We'll talk some off-season NBA and Raptors with Samson Folk a little later. Dennis Bernstein on the NHL. Ian Hunter on those Blue Jays. Lee Hacksaw Hamilton on baseball as well. And again, 590-590 is the text, name and location. On Twitter at the Raj 590. And you can email Roger at Sportsnet590.ca. We say good morning to our leadoff hitter. It's a good one. David Alter, Maple Leaf reporter at the Hockey News. Talk some off-season NHL. David, great to have you on the show as always, my friend. And, well, let's start with the Leafs. They've done a lot of body of work here as we get into free agency. Your report card on what they've done here in the early days of free agency, David.
Yeah, you know, I think it would be somewhere in the B range. I don't really think they had a lot that they could do going into this, just given that they're very tight on cap space. They can't really make the plunge. A lot is talked about how teams make mistakes and overpay on day one. It didn't look like that was necessarily the case, but the Leafs just didn't have the cash to throw away and spend. And what they were challenged or tasked to do, like they've been tasked in the later parts of last season, is try and find value. Guys that you can work on as projects that can possibly be home runs for minimum spend. And they tried doing that. Nick Ritchie is probably their biggest swing at it. The forward who could play on the top six on the wing, who spent last season with Anaheim and with Boston and then Anaheim before that. I think that's probably the big one there. Michael Bunting is another project who has a ridiculous shooting percentage, which is probably not sustainable, but also a project and a player that the Leafs are very familiar with. So, look, I mean, the Leafs did what they could, but they're definitely going to have a challenge this season when it comes to some depth. And that just goes with the fact that they have four players that make up half their cap hit, but they believe in those four players, and so they're sticking with it. And the Leafs, I think, did the best they could do with the amount of cap space available. And we should also mention Peter Mrazek as well. So bolstering the goaltending, I thought they could do what they could do. They still probably need a depth defenseman, but about that, aside from that, I think that's about what they could do this offseason.
I think that's a good summation, David. So, you know, the core four takes up most of the salary, so we got that. And I think another interesting element is, though, you know, David, and we talked last year's team, the value that a Thornton, you know, Simmons, Spezza bring to the team. And it's only $750,000. So, of course, you're going to have those guys. However, one thing about guys like that is that, yes, they're cheap. It is fantastic. They want to finish their careers and everything else. But they do take up ice time from other people in terms of who's on the depth chart and how you work it out. So while the discussion revolves around that core four, as it should, and how difficult it is to manage, and on first blush, you would think those cheap $750,000 contracts, no problem one way or the other. But when you look at the number of bodies they're bringing in, do you see a crunch time period here at some point where, you know, presuming a Spezza, Thornton, and even Simmons to a certain extent come back next year, that we may see them more of a healthy scratch? Like, how do you build that depth when you got that many players at the bottom that are that old?
Well, I mean, I think the key thing in that, Raj, is when Kyle Dubas, the Leafs general manager, was making his availability, they also said that they lost a lot of key AHL players and that they would have to fill out the roster that way. And so I looked at what the Leafs were doing and I looked at the number of bodies, and you just go to any website, look at what they've done and how many bodies they are and how many roster spots there are. And there is a surplus. There's no doubt about that. So what might happen, and what usually does happen when you have a surplus, is that day before the season is that waiver wire frenzy where all these players who are on one-way deals, or not necessarily one-way deals, but who are eligible for waivers, have to be put on waivers before they can get moved down or away from the lineup, because there's going to be scratches, but the Leafs are so up against the cap that they could probably only carry 20 or 21 players on the active roster. So you're going to have, you know, the Gabriels, maybe the Simmons, maybe the Engvalls go on the waiver wire and have to play in the AHL a little bit to start. And as injuries come up, they can then recall them and play into those spots. But there's a lot of projects there that may make the team, but if not, they're just going to have to play in the NHL, and the Marlies have a hole when it comes to talent to field that lineup because they lost a lot of players in the system as well.
Will be interesting to see how it all sorts out. So you talked about Peter Mrazek, and I found that an interesting signing. So, you know, and when you look back, you know, David, the last few years, it's all been about Freddie Anderson. But when you see the way the NHL is going now, so now the goaltending situation is Campbell and Mrazek. I mean, you know, they're paying Peter Mrazek $3.8 million. You know he's going to play. Jack Campbell certainly established himself into the playoffs, over the playoffs this year. How do you feel about that tandem, David?
I think it works. I think the Leafs were in a difficult spot where they knew that they couldn't get Anderson back under the same dynamic as where he came in. It's a very difficult thing. It's not that there's necessarily egos, but, you know, when Frederik Anderson said he knows his worth and had to sit out for a while and saw Jack Campbell take the reins there, you kind of knew the situation he was going to was different than the one he signed to back in 2016. So I think bringing in someone like Mrazek, who has ambition but is also a good team player and knows how to play in that tandem dynamic, will help challenge Jack, support him, but also make it a situation where the Leafs have kind of made it clear that, you know, you had a really good year last year, but we need to see a whole body of work. We need to see we need to have some depth in the position because there were injury issues. So I think this is a perfect duo that you can have here. A big game goaltender who's put up numbers and but also has ambition for more, but can be a team player if Jack is the guy. So I don't think he goes into this with that term not thinking that there's opportunity, but knowing that Jack Campbell had a pretty good year last year. So it was it's weird to see goalies flip-flop in cities like that, but it kind of made sense for both players and team situations where Jack Campbell, the Leafs believe that he can be the guy, but he's going into the final year of his deal. They got some term with Mrazek, and Mrazek is a capable goaltender who can play starter minutes. So I think it's the perfect situation that the Leafs were kind of put in.
Your point is bang on in terms of, like, it just happens that Mrazek and Anderson switch teams, but it's circumstances, it's cap, it's money, it's expectations. So I totally get that. And I think, too, David, you know, we see in the NHL now the trend is, you know, well, and in the case of Freddie Anderson for a lot of years, it's Anderson and just get a backup. Now it's a case of, you know, you need two goaltenders in the National Hockey League. It's just more and more you look around every single team, that value, and correspondingly so, the amount of money you're going to have to pay to get a backup, and maybe not even call him a backup. It's your second option, you know, David. The days of Marty Brodeur playing 72 games are over.
Yeah, no, they are. And, you know, the biggest telling point for me about how weird the goalie situations have kind of developed, and it had nothing to do with the top level. It had to deal with the depth levels. And I brought this example up the day before the regular season while all the players get put on waivers. Remember, a couple of years ago, the Leafs had depth goaltending and they lost two goaltenders, Calvin Pickard and Curtis McElhinney, on the same day to waivers. And right away, they were stuck with 4-2 goalies. And teams are now just looking for depth, that if you even dare to put a depth goaltender who can play on the waiver wire, then you're going to get claimed. So I think that the teams understand that depth at that position is so important wherever you can get it. And that seems to be a very favorable spot where teams can get it. So now it's a situation where you got to have depth in that spot. Injuries are going to happen. We're going to have another compressed season in terms of the schedule, not in terms of the games because of the Olympic break. And so health at that position, like any other position, is going to be key.
David Alter with us from the Hockey News. I'm Roger Lajoie, Sportsnet Today and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Great you're along with us on this Sunday morning. So Zach Hyman is gone. No surprise. No surprise he signed with the Edmonton Oilers, because that was the scuttlebutt for a good week before it got done. David, last year, the core four is always the discussion of this team. But so many people last year, and rightfully so, praise Zach Hyman as being at times maybe as valuable as anybody on this roster. So when you lose a player of that magnitude, whether you subscribe to that degree of importance or not is another issue. But when you lose a player of that magnitude, who's replacing him? Do they have enough to do that? Because when you look at the value that he brought last year, it's definitely a subtraction. And then when you look at the rest of the roster juggling, to be honest with you, I don't see another Zach Hyman.
Yeah, well, I think that's what they're kind of hoping in terms of the by committee, Richie being the kind of leader in that regard, who can be in that spot. Go back to the contract that Zach Hyman was on and around the age that he was at when he signed it. That's kind of where Nick Richie's at in that respect. Well, although Richie has more years of NHL experience because Hyman came later because of college days. But that's, I think, where they're kind of looking into that spot with someone like Nick Richie. He can play on the power play. He can move up into those top six and play those minutes if needed, although he's traditionally been a third-line guy. Andre Kasha is another player that the Leafs brought in who missed most of last year with concussion issues, but before that could put up points in that respect. And Michael Bunting is another project that may or may not be able to kind of slide into that spot based on chemistry. I think they look at where those players were and where Zach Hyman was and not where Zach Hyman is, that they could figure if they put him with elite talent that they can hope that those players drive those lines again and there isn't the substantial drop-off without Hyman. Because remember, when all things were ideal for the Leafs, during last season, and that wasn't ever the case. But when it was, they had Zach Hyman moving down to the third line and tried different wingers like Foligno into that spot. Simmons played on the second line for a good chunk of time and had success in February before he got hurt. And there was a lot of line juggling when they put Thornton on the first line before moving him down. And having Galchenyuk up there, who was a project that they turned into a capable possible second line spot. So the Leafs feel internally that they have that track record, that they can develop that. It's all going to depend on the chemistry with that skilled talent, and there could be a learning curve there. So that's where that Zach Hyman replacement comes in for them and how they're approaching it.
So we've already talked about how difficult it is for the Leafs in their salary cap situation, David, to make moves. I got to presume it's going to be very difficult for them to do anything else. When you look at the roster and you look at the math, like and especially, you know, in early parts of the free agent period, a lot of people are saying, well, there's still going to be players out there in value. Do you expect much activity now between now and training camp for the Maple Leafs?
I don't, but there's always that talk that maybe they create space with Alex Kerfoot, because they have Alex Kerfoot at a moderate cap hit, who's kind of a hybrid guy that could be of value to a team that needs him in a particular spot, where right now when you look at the lines and you try and play fantasy coach, there's a lot of different opinions about where Alex Kerfoot fits in. Well, if you have these left wingers that can plug into that spot, do you put Kerfoot back in his center spot that he played for much of last year, or do you have no choice but to make him a second-line left winger because you're kind of stuck? And that's why you brought someone like a David Kampfen from Chicago who could kind of move in and be your cheaper Philip Deneau defensive center, depth center in that spot. So that's where that factors in. So you're right, I don't factor a lot of moves. I still think that they do want to add a defenseman in the bottom pair, a veteran presence, if there is one to be had there. Maybe if they want to create cap space, they can move Kerfoot. That's the only move I can possibly see. But other than that, they're kind of stuck in that spot. And then you're right. At that point, they kind of have to stay at the minimum roster level if they want to get daily cap accrual and add during the regular season. Because once there's injuries, then they have to go into LTI and then daily cap accrual is not a thing anymore. So there's a lot there that the Leafs experienced during this shortened season that we had that they've kind of learned from, that they kind of have to look at what makes sense. And so I don't think it's fully figured out yet. And I think Kerfoot is the wild card. If there is moves, in the summer, I think it revolves around him if it's a move to create space.
David Alter with us from the Hockey News. So comes down to it, David, the rubber hits the road with this, you know, people's opinion of the Maple Leafs is quite simple. So the organization has made it quite clear. The core four are their guys. They're going with those guys. We've seen the offseason moves they have made. The Maple Leafs, as we all know, have not won a playoff series in 17 years, whatever it is now. Is this team got a better chance of winning a playoff series this year than they did last year, in your opinion?
I think it's about the same. And I only say that because the regular season, I think, is going to be the bigger challenge than it is getting into the playoffs altogether for the Leafs. Because as much as people wanted to dismiss the all-Canadian division narrative, I never did. I always looked at that division being weaker on a regular basis. And you could see it by the fact that the Leafs never relinquished the division as of early February. Like, they had it, and anytime a team came close, they created the distance and went away. The Leafs are not going to have that situation this year. And because of that, they're going to go up against – you go from playing against six teams all year long to playing against 31 teams. And there's going to be a different dynamic and a different way to adjust and a different factor in, and better teams in your division this time, I think most people would agree with, when it comes to franchises like Tampa, Boston, even Florida, and Montreal's back, and Ottawa might be better. So that's going to be the big hill for the Leafs. Whether it comes to actually winning a playoff round and going factor in, I don't think that's necessarily going to be a harder thing next year, because I think the playoffs are going to be relatively the same for the Leafs in terms of that challenge. It's really going to be, is the full season race with the tougher division going to be a challenge for them to get into the playoffs? I think it's going to be a little harder for them this year. And that's where these projects and these, like, gambling on low players and hoping that they can hit a home run, I think there's going to be more pressure on those players, where there wasn't so much pressure on someone like Galchenyuk and other players, because the Leafs were in such a luxurious position from the early onset of the season. I think that's the number one difference this year.
So, final question, we'll let you go, David. There's not much doubt that there's always pressure on front office executives and coaches in Toronto and the Maple Leafs. There's no doubt about it. However, as we head into this season, one would assume, and not really assume, this organization feels pretty confident in sticking with their four, and they feel pretty confident in their job security. Quite often. Do you see it that way? Do you see any kind of a sense of, I know the fan base is impatient. We saw it with Washington. We saw it with Tampa Bay. We've seen a lot of teams. It takes a while. Back in the day, Detroit, you have your playoff failures, you break through, and all of a sudden everything's okay. And that's the kind of hope. But if it doesn't happen this year, at some point, is the onus either going to be on the organization to give up this core four, make a move, do something, or is it going to be they're just going to trot this out and they feel confident enough that it happens? I mean, I guess in a long-winded way, I'm trying to ask you, if this team doesn't even make the playoffs next year, someone's going to pay the price, right?
Yeah, I would think that there would be some sort of change, whether it's from a team breaking up the core four, moving one player to address something else, or even personnel. But what was really telling was, when the Leafs had their end-of-season news conference with Brendan Shanahan and Kyle Dubas and Sheldon Keefe, primarily through someone like Dubas, I think when you keep citing examples with Tampa after a couple of years, like, well, you know, this is the pain before whatever, and then before that it was adding, you know, you got to add some of these toughness and things that Tampa had, which the Leafs did end up doing for that shortened season. I think at that point, you're kind of out of the excuses at that point. Like, there's not really much you can do, especially when you didn't change much of the roster. If you don't have playoff success of any kind, I don't think there will be a standard to accept it, because at that point, it will be the definition of insanity. But if it goes their way and they win another round, they buy themselves some time, and people like the plan. I think the Leafs, in the front office, I don't think they're necessarily, in the from a higher level, are necessarily interested in making a change for change's sake, unless there's something better out there. But I think so much of this team is kind of built in for the next few years that if they win a playoff round, they're going to continue to try and go with it. But if not, you're absolutely right. They have to make some sort of tectonic shift in what they're doing, not just from appeasing the fan sake, but for business sake. This is a team that needs to kind of look for the future. And after that, your core will only be around for another couple of years because of some of the short-term contracts that they signed someone like Matthews on, who only has 1 year of unrestricted free agency bought out of his contract. So you'll have to start looking at that regard and building for the future at that point.
David Alter joining us from the Hockey News. The Maple Leafs are always interesting in season and off season. And boy, just because of the calendar and the schedule and the COVID, it won't be long before we're back into hockey once again as free agency continues. David, you're a good man. Stay well, sir. Thanks so much.
Raj, always a pleasure. In 54 days until the Leafs' first preseason.
See, there you go. It's right around the corner. Thanks so much, David.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you.
David Alter, Maple Leaf reporter from the Hockey News. 54 days to the next. Huh? What? Less than 2 months? Bring it on. Sportsnet today, Roger Lajoie on Twitter at the Raj590. 66% of you so far say the Jays are going to make the playoffs. 34% of you say no. We've got some comments as well on Twitter, email, and text. If you're texting, 590-590-590-590. Name and location, please, if you are texting, okay? Name and location, please, on your text. Roger at sportsnet590.ca is the email. And on Twitter, at the Raj590. We'll get your thoughts on that. Samson Folk talk about the Raptors offseason. Where do they go after their draft? Dennis Bernstein with more NHL coverage. Ian Hunter on those Blue Jays. And Lee Hamilton on MLB. So all that to come in the show. Coming up, though, we, on the weekend shows, usually play a top interview of the past week. And Luke Prokop is the first active gay player under an NHL contract. Came out and... what do you say? How does that feel? Is now going to be the trend? Is it going to create an environment where people will feel comfortable doing that? Scotty Mack and Mike Zygmunt had him on the lead off. Terrific interview. We're going to play that for you next. As Sportsnet Today continues, I'm Roger Lajoie on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet Today and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Roger Lajoie here until 1 o'clock. Blue Jay baseball comes up at 1 o'clock. Ben Wagner with the call right here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. And we'll have Jay's talk right after the game. So stick around for that. Stick around the next couple of hours. Samson Folk talk some off-season Raptors. Dennis Bernstein on the National Hockey League. Ian Hunter on the Blue Jays. Lee Hacksaw Hamilton still to come. And your thoughts are welcome at the Raj590 on Twitter. Email Roger at sportsnet590.ca, or you can text 590-590. If you're texting, please, your name and your location. Your thoughts on our poll. The Blue Jays going to make the playoffs. Yes or no? I am saying yes. I just think this team is ready to go on a roll. I really do. And get into the playoffs. Are they going to win the division? Likely not. Are they going to catch Tampa Bay even? Actually, Tampa Bay may catch Boston. So are they going to be first or second in the division? Well, they dug themselves such a hole, that will be tough. But this team is set up the same way the team was set up in 2015, 2016, 2015 in particular, at the trade deadline, to just really get on a hot streak. That all said, they have to take advantage of teams like Kansas City, as they've done in the first two games of this. And so it seems basically you got to win most of your games if you're going to be a playoff team when you dig yourself a hole like this. They've got to beat the teams ahead of them when they play them. That simple. And I say they do it. But your thoughts are welcome. Your comments, we'll read them throughout the course of the show. And again, please, if you're texting, folks, I need your name and location on your text for the Blue Jays. Luke Prokop, first active gay player under an NHL contract. After coming out, he joined Scotty Mack and Mike Zygmunt on the leadoff. It's our top interview of the week. Let's listen.
So let's set the stage here for just a moment. You're 19 years old, your chosen profession, the sport that you have excelled at throughout the entire youthful years of your life, your adolescence, is hockey. And you are looking ahead to a career in this sport. But you have a secret, and you have a secret that you worry may compromise your chances to thrive in your chosen profession, in the profession in which you excel. I would imagine that Luke Prokop has felt these things, but last week he ripped off the Band-Aid and in a social media post shared with the hockey world and the broader world that he is a gay man. And Luke is good enough to take some time this morning to share with us what the last week has been like and where things go from here. Luke, first of all, good morning and congratulations. Thank you for joining us. And I will start with that question. What has the last week or so been like for you?
Well, I appreciate you having me on, Scott, and good morning to you as well. The last week has been crazy. You know, from all the text messages I've been getting to seeing people in the rink, in the gym, you know, come up to me and, you know, tell me how proud they are of me and congratulate me. It's been a whirlwind, and my emotions have kind of been everywhere. But, you know, this week is kind of the start of a new life for me, really. And I couldn't be happier with how it's gone so far.
Luke, when you made the decision to come out, and you know, Pierre LeBrun wrote a wonderful article detailing your story in The Athletic, and I encourage anyone to go and read it. But when you made the decision to come out, what went into that, and how long a period of time was there between I know I've got to do this and the day where you actually did it?
I sat down with my agents and told them I was gay in June of 2020 after our season ended because of COVID. And when I sat down with them at lunch and told them that, they, you know, we kind of talked for a little bit. And then they said, you know, we kind of have two options here, Luke. We can, you know, keep this private and you can live your life, you know, kind of the way you want to, which is totally fine and up to you. And then the other one is you can come out publicly and sort of be this, you know, inspiration to younger kids and, you know, be that representation that's so much needed in hockey. And that's kind of what I had always leaned to, you know, especially growing up. I sound like a broken record saying this all the time now, but, you know, when I talk to my friends and family about hockey, they were always worried about, you know, if I could continue playing hockey. And I said, you know what, if I can have a career in hockey where I make some sort of impact, you know, that lasts when I'm outside of the game, I would way rather have that than a career with, you know, 3 Stanley Cups and 2 Norris Trophies. Obviously, that's great, and I'd want that for accolades in my career as well, but I'd way rather be known for something outside, making an impact outside the game. And so that happens, and flash forward now to probably May of 2021. I had just gotten back from my season in Calgary, and I had gotten to the point, you know, with my coming out where I believed everyone needed to know, you know, in my close circle, and I didn't really care about what anyone else thought of me. I wanted to be who I was. So in May of 2021, I sat down with my agent, and I said, I want to come out publicly. And, you know, we kind of mapped out the steps on how to do it. And, you know, it was an amazing process. And one, I'm so thankful for having, you know, my agents, my family, and my friends being so supportive of.
Luke, a lot of what you have said just now, I can't relate to the hockey part necessarily, but a lot of what you've said just now, a lot of what you shared with Pierre LeBrun, I saw some of those quotes and I'm like, oh my goodness, Luke is almost saying the words that I've uttered a few times. And so this is how relatable your story is to so many different people. When you came up with the Calgary Hitmen, you know, you're 3 or 4 years younger than you are now. I would presume that you had a pretty good idea of your sexuality. What was your experience like in your earliest days and through your years in the Western Hockey League?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of, you know, I've known I was gay for probably 3, 4, 5 years, and that's kind of really when I understood it. I mean, sorry, I'll say I knew I was gay my whole life, but I really only understood it, you know, 3, 4, or 5 years ago, coming to terms with my sexuality. And, you know, it's hard. I mean, obviously, in hockey, I mean, homophobic language is a very real thing. And, you know, there were times where, you know, stuff would be said in the locker room or on the bus or in a certain situation, and I would just feel very uncomfortable with it. And I didn't have anyone to talk to. And that was probably the hardest part, you know, being around the locker room. You're with those guys 24/7 and not having someone to talk to about, you know, kind of what you're going through because you're too scared to talk about it was really hard for me. So I was lucky enough, and I felt, you know, I felt comfortable telling two of my teammates going into this past season, our past COVID season, and, you know, I couldn't thank them enough. You know, they were excellent with it, and, you know, whenever there was a topic of sexuality that came up in the dressing room or just a situation where they thought I might be uncomfortable, they always came up to me afterwards and just checked in to see how I was doing. You know, I could talk to them about really anything I wanted to, and, you know, that's nothing. I couldn't ask for more of them, which I'm very thankful for them.
With Luke Prokop on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. So my boyfriend Xander has 4 nephews. They are all teenagers, and the oldest is your age. And what Xander tells me from his understanding of his nephews is that in your generation, sexuality is just kind of be as you are, be who you are. And I would imagine, and I understand in reading your article, talking to you now, that there is, of course, still a coming out process, and that hockey and being so involved, there would be hesitation around that. But within your generation, Luke, like, you don't know a Canada where equal marriage isn't the law. I think you were 3 years old when it became law. So you've only known a world in Canada where 2 consenting adults who love each other can get married if they so choose. Would you say that your generation, your experience, life so far, your generation is accepting and is generally loving toward LGBTQ plus people?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it seems like with each generation, it kind of gets filtered through a bit more where people don't care as much. You know, I've played with, you know, people, and I've had friends who, you know, haven't come out, but, you know, they've had, you know, they were a girl and they had a girlfriend, or they were a boy and they had a boyfriend. And no one really turned a head and said, oh, that's wrong. They just were like, oh, okay, like, I'm happy for you. And, you know, that's what with hockey, you know, it's almost a stereotype of an old boys club, and you kind of get scared with the fact that, you know, you might get weeded out just because you're different. And that was definitely one of my concerns.
With Luke Prokop on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. We know David Poile, the general manager of your pro team, the Nashville Predators, has been extremely supportive of you. Have you heard from any of your potential future Predators teammates?
Yeah, so I was working a lot with Bane Pettinger and Brock McGillis, mm-hmm. you know, the 2-3 weeks leading up to my announcement. And Bane obviously he's an agent and represented, you know, a couple guys on Nashville. And, you know, we thought it would be a good idea if we put each other into a group chat and just kind of gave them the heads up. Because, you know, obviously they're going to get asked questions as well. And so I got put in a group chat with the whole leadership group in Nashville, and then also some, you know, some other players as well who are well known in the organization, and they just wanted to give me their little veto of just confidence in me, and wanted to make sure that I know that, you know, they support me 1,000%, and that they'll have my back no matter what. And I mean, at the end of the day, I'm just there to I'm there to be a hockey player. You know, I'm there to be me. I'm there to, you know, try to help win a Stanley Cup. So that doesn't change anything for them.
And let's get into the hockey side of things here. I mean, when did you first have a sense? At what age and when did you first have a sense that, I can really make something out of this?
Probably when I was, so when I was 14 was really when I noticed I was different from everyone else. You know, that was kind of the age where guys would in the dressing room would start talking about girls and, you know, stuff like that. And it just didn't really interest me. And then probably I really didn't start thinking about it till I was 16, 17 was when I was like, really like, hey, like I could I could make a difference in a lot of people's lives if this was something I chose to do. And then I just had to get to a point where, you know, I needed to tell my family and friends. I needed to get to a point where I didn't care about what anyone else thought. And I just needed to get to a place where I was comfortable in my life and with my sexuality and telling people about who I was.
And in terms, Luke, I mean, you're 6'5", you're well north of 200 pounds. Tell us about the type of player you are on the ice. I mean, we'll follow your career with interest, and we'll hope for a lot of years and a lot of success. But when we watch you play, what kind of player are we going to see?
Well, I like to think of myself as a two-way defenseman who takes a real lot of pride in his own end. I'm a great skater. I've got a really good stick. I have a high hockey IQ. And, you know, I'm not afraid to jump up in the rush every once in a while. And I'm looking to kind of show more of my offensive side these next, you know, 1 or 2 years left I have in junior hockey. And, yeah, that's sort of the really, really the player that I am.
With Luke Prokop on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Just in closing, Luke, and, you know, I don't want to take your story and make it about me or anyone else in particular, but as I stated earlier, I feel that there are so many commonalities and so much that one LGBTQ plus person can relate to when they hear the story of another LGBTQ plus person. And I think the thing that I'm happiest for when I found out, like everybody else did last week, that you were coming out as a gay man, is that when I look at my life, my biggest regret is that I didn't share with my parents until I was 36. I didn't share with others until about 37, 38. And then because of the nature of my job and the fact that I felt I needed to live openly and honestly, I didn't share with the public until a couple of years ago when I was 40. And one of the things I've had to forgive myself for and reconcile in myself is the notion of a lost youth. Lost teenage years, lost 20s, really in some ways lost 30s. And I'm just so happy for you that at 19 years old, whether you play one game in the NHL, whether you play 1,000 games in the NHL, whether you're a Norris Trophy winner, a multiple Stanley Cup champion, whatever it is you are, whatever you do with your life, you will do it as you. And so I congratulate you for this. I thank you for this. And I doubt you will ever truly know. You may be made somewhat aware of it, but I doubt you will ever truly know the number of lives you have positively affected and saved through the decision you made last week. And I don't say that to place an extended burden on you or anything. I just relay it to share my view, the degree of importance on what you did last week. And I thank you for it, and I congratulate you.
Thank you, Scott. I really appreciate that. Those are very, very kind words. And, yeah, I don't really think I'll ever really understand how big of an impact this might make on people's lives. And, you know, that's all I hoped for. If I could just impact one person, then I've done my job.
Luke Prokop on Leadoff with Scotty Mac. We pick a top interview on our weekend shows, play it all the time. That one was number one. Every other interview on the station this week was tied for second. And when you see and listen to the pain people have, the only thing I'll add, there's really nothing you can add to it, but the only thing I will add for that, you know, when Scott talked about his coming out at age 40 officially in the public, and I remember watching it, and I saw the pain. Scott's just such a wonderful guy. And what really bothers me is the pain these people have to go through. So clearly, as a society, we say, many of us, live and let live and live how you want to live. And we're not allowing people to do that without fear. And here, my hope to all of them is that they get an opportunity. Mayor Jim Watson of Ottawa came out as gay recently, and he said something that struck me very profound. He said, it just denied me a life of love. And Scott said, you know, all those years, he didn't tell his parents, he didn't tell anybody. I believe Jim is in his 60s or close to it. And the pain they have to go through. And here's hoping that people moving forward, thanks to brave people like our own Scott MacArthur and Luke Prokop, make it possible for younger generations not to have to do that again. There is no need. Live how you want to live. I'm Roger Lajoie. Sportsnet Today continues in a moment on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Together, right now, over me. Sportsnet Today and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Roger Lajoie with you until 1 o'clock. Blue Jay baseball is on the way. Jays wrap up their first series back at Rogers Center against the Kansas City Royals. Ben Wagner with the call. And Jays talk right after the game with Josh Goldberg and Rob Wong. The emotion of Friday night is just, I would say you can't describe it, but I'd like you to describe it on Twitter at the Rog 590 or text 590-590 or email Roger at sportsnet590.ca. If you were fortunate enough to be in the ballpark, obviously we'd love your views. And just watching at home with your family, your thoughts. And I think all through COVID and all through the time that we have been through as a society and a world in the last 16 months, I guess it's been, one of the things I think all of us have thought about is when we get back, what's it going to be like, your first game, your first concert? Well, we've had one. So your thoughts are welcome. Your emotions and feelings are great. And this Blue Jay team, what they did at the trade deadline, are they now good enough to be a playoff team? Yes or no? That's the poll on Twitter today at the Rog 590. Yes or no? Simple question. Are the Jays going to make the playoffs with the moves they made? They're going to be exciting, and this team is going to do great things. This year, all right, maybe not, but give your comments on that as well. Coming up, Samson Folk on the Raptors off season, and Dennis Bernstein on the NHL. Ian Hunter on those Jays. I'm Roger Lajoie, Sportsnet Today, Sportsnet Radio Network. So hard to see. Come together right now.
Over me. Sportsnet Today on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Rumors spreading around in that Texas town about the Shaq outside the game. And you know what I'm talking about.
Sportsnet Today and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Roger Lajoie here till 1 o'clock. Blue Jay baseball is on the way. Jays and Royals. 1 p.m. Blue Jays looking for a sweep of the Royals in their first series back at Rogers Center. And what a time it has been at Rogers Center Friday and Saturday. The emotion in the ballpark was something else. If you were there or watched on TV, give us your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions. You can do it on Twitter at the Rog 590. Email Roger at sportsnet590.ca. Text 590-590 with name and location. We've got lots of feedback. We will get to a couple of texts here before we talk to Samson Folk, co-host of the Minute Basketball podcast. Noah in Newmarket texts us in and says, I took my girlfriend to her first baseball game on Friday night, and as someone who has been to many a game at Rogers Center, I don't think I will ever get as good an atmosphere outside of a Game 7 of a World Series. Noah, thank you very much. The atmosphere was tremendous. It was just a fantastic night. And that is very well said. Bruce in Penetanguishing says, my wife and I watched Friday's game and were moved to tears. Well done, Jays. Thank you, Bruce. Well done on the text. Jays deserve a lot of credit. You look at a situation like that, how do you handle it? And At some first blush, some people might think, wow, it's easy. It's not easy. Like, well, you know, what are you going to do? Have an hour-long ceremony? It's not like the traditional opening day. I thought they did it spectacularly well. It was a perfect length. I really, really thought, you know what, 20 minutes, yeah, that's enough. It really is. And the way they brought the Jays on, it was fantastic. And the fans to throw out the first pitch. Perfect. Not the mayor. And even, you know, as much as we honor the first responders and the healthcare professionals who are heroes and have done so much to keep us safe during this pandemic, this was about the fans, a return to somewhat normal. So kudos to them. It was great. Got lots of reaction on Twitter at the Raj 590. I will read your tweets, I promise you. 590-590 text, name and location, please. I'll read those as well throughout the course of the show here until 1 o'clock. Later in the hour, Dennis Bernstein on the NHL. Right now, Raptors and how they sit in the offseason. Samson Folk is the co-host of a Minute Basketball Podcast to chat some Raptors. Samson, great to have you on the show. And so let's start with Scotty Barnes. That was the story of the draft. And it's funny, you know, because in this day and age, there's so much draft information online. Even if you're not watching a lot of college basketball, everybody's got an opinion and everybody's supposed to go with the list. And if you go off the board or you don't take the guy, all kinds of stuff. I found the reaction on social media to drafting Scotty Barnes kind of funny from that perspective, Samson. But your thoughts on the pick and how draft night went for the Raptors?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, first of all. But I think it was a mixed bag for the most part. You're referring to how much information is online. The landscape of draft analysts has really changed a lot. Guys get hired into front offices off of Twitter. So something to consider, which is really interesting. But Scotty Barnes, the Raptors, they say they chose him because he was the best player available to them. They obviously see a future where they have a very seamless, positionless team that presumably incorporates Pascal Siakam, OG Anunoby, and Scotty Barnes. And they'll be able to switch across a lot of defensive schemes. They'll have a lot of different guys who are able to play a number of styles offensively. And that's obviously what they were going for. And if the rumors, the reports are true, they're higher on Scotty Barnes and Jalen Suggs. So if they like their guy, it's hard to blame them if they like their guy. But David Johnson and Banton, the Canadian kid, that Banton is really interesting because he is like 6'9", plays point guard nominally quite a bit of the time. And David Johnson is kind of like not particularly the mold of Fred VanVleet because he's quite a bit bigger, but he does project as more of a 3-and-D guard. So it seems like, and Champagne, I guess, the undrafted free agent at the end, but Scotty Barnes is the big swing. The other two guys, you're probably going to look for summer league to see what you've got. But Scotty Barnes, if everything translates properly, if he can work on the jump shot, then you're looking at a guy who maybe can punch up at a few all-star games. And, you know, if the pull-up game comes along, then you start looking at, you know, a ceiling even higher than that.
You know, it's interesting, Samson, and it's a great description of the kind of player Barnes is projected to be by the Raptors. But I go back again, you know, to this consensus number 4 pick or consensus number 7 pick or whatever the case may be, going off a list. And sometimes I really think it's some people in particular in the media who want to be proven right, that their draft list, you know, corresponded with the way it's supposed to go. And outside of, you know, in a lot of years where, yeah, the consensus number 1 pick is, you know, LeBron James is in the draft, everybody's taking him, everybody knows that. I do get that. When you stop and you look at it, and it's not basketball, but from the hockey world that I'm more involved in and been with teams where the draft is there, I've heard general managers saying, if my scouts just come back with the same list as central scouting or general consensus or whatever it is, why do I have scouts in the first place? And yet everybody, you know, seems to think the draft order is supposed to go in the draft order, and you're going off I don't think you're going off anybody's board. You're just trusting your people and their thoughts. And if everybody's thinking the same, Samson, nobody's thinking. Is that not the case? And especially in this case, when you see it in a high pick as number 4, the entire discussion to me is a moot situation. And if you want to go on track record, well, Samson, I think we can all agree the Toronto Raptors done a pretty good job in the draft over the years.
Yeah, that's a great point. As you brought up with the consensus number one pick thing, sometimes there are transcendent outliers who everybody will have them at a certain place. But the Raptors, who have, you know, later in the draft, there's always a lot more, it's way more volatile. But the Raptors have shown a really great nose for picking up players who have obviously ascended way higher than their draft status would usually predict. OG Anunoby, Pascal Siakam, Norman Powell, Fred VanVleet, who they didn't even draft. But I do think you're absolutely correct. There is a different heuristic, a different idea for how to analyze players and project them. And the Raptors have shown they're very good at that. So they went with Scottie Barnes, who they valued over Jalen Suggs. I was a person who thought, you know, I wanted Suggs. But once again, like you said, you want to be correct. You want them to choose your guy. But to, you know, allow what you previously thought to cloud how you cheer for or how you support the new draft pick, that's the wrong thing. I think everybody should be very ready to support Scottie Barnes, who's had the Raptors draft cap kind of stuck to his head 24/7. Every picture that's taken of him, he's still wearing the hat he put on when he was drafted. So,
yeah, you know, he played the role very, very well of the latest Raptor. There's no doubt. And it's nice to see a guy who's happy to be in the organization, without question. Samson Folk is with us, co-host of Minute Basketball Podcast. I'm Roger Lajoie as we talk off-season in the Raptors. The big question in the off-season for the Raptors, now the draft is done, now we get into free agency, of course, is Kyle Lowry. A lot of rumors with Miami this morning. There's been a lot of destinations for Lowry, as there should be. And it remains the big unanswered question, Samson, is, you know, we talk about what kind of an off-season the Raptors are going to have. It really does revolve around the fact of whether or not Lowry is coming back to Toronto, right?
Yeah, 100% agreed. I think it's really interesting that if Lowry comes back, the team is obviously going to be, I think, quite a bit better. And if Lowry does come back, we might see them swing a little bit harder at a standout guy at the five position, a Rashawn Holmes maybe. Or maybe they try and make a trade, something like that, that doesn't incorporate Lowry. But a lot of the smoke, a lot of the rumors indicate that a sign and trade sending Lowry somewhere appears to be the most likely way forward. That's also what we thought at the trade deadline, though, that he was gone. So I guess we'll wait and see. Kyle Lowry appears to be very focused on collecting one more large paycheck, which he should. He's a fantastic player. He should get paid well. So if the Raptors are willing to pony up in a way that other teams aren't, then we might see him there. And maybe there's other intangibles that haven't been leaked that we don't know, but he brings a much higher ceiling to the team for next year if he stays.
So this is a harder question to answer, but you brought it up, Samson, in terms of you believe if Lowry comes back, the Raptors are going to be quite a bit better, and that, you know, gets him into, all right, let's really look at 2022 here. We have an opportunity to compete. If he doesn't, of course, so many other factors come into play, how they replace him, what else they do, clears the cap space for them and everything else. But where do you sign on, is it your wish Kyle Lowry comes back and the Raptors do open the vault? Because let's face it, there's not going to be any hometown discount in this. If they want Kyle Lowry to finish his career as a Raptor, they're going to have to pay him as the premier player. And is that something, all emotion aside, that they're better off doing at this stage?
I do like the idea of paying Kyle Lowry to stay in town because, A, he's still a super effective player. If he's signing like a 3-year, $75, $80 million contract, is he going to be super effective by the third year? Maybe not. I guess we'll see if that does happen. But the Raptors, as currently constructed, and, you know, by the track record of the team, free agents, and it's not just the Raptors being in Canada or anything, but Sacramento doesn't really get free agents. Neither do a lot of other teams. There's basically five teams that get marquee free agents. A lot of them are based in popular U.S. cities that either are New York or have really good weather. And Toronto isn't one of those. So spending money on Kyle Lowry, that it would be tough to spend that money elsewhere on a player of a similar caliber, you might as well run it back and keep a franchise icon if he's willing to stay. And then if he starts dwindling, you assess once you're there. But he's still a very good player. You probably can't spend that money better elsewhere at this point. And honestly, it probably makes it more viable that Pascal Siakam and Fred VanVleet get a little bit more of a run out of their primes as well. So I do like the idea of bringing him back. I guess it's a little bit dependent on what the trade return might be. The rumored packages out of Miami, KZ Opala in a couple seconds, that's not going to intrigue anyone very much. But the fact is you're either trading Kyle Lowry's, you know, the rights to sign him, which isn't the same as him on the trade market, or you're keeping him. And I think keeping him is a pretty good idea right now.
Sampson, it's interesting because, you know, you look at the overall direction of the franchise, which way they're going. And now, once again, a lot of it has to do, you know, maybe with the fact that they draft Scottie Barnes. But some people think, is that an indication that maybe Pascal Siakam would eventually be dealt, if not this year, in another year? Yeah. The Leafs are famous for their core four. The Raptors, you know, situation, I mean, bringing the band back, so to speak, if Lowry does resign. But there's still so much kind of talk about, is Siakam the guy? I mean, if he's the guy, you don't even entertain, there's not even a thought. But it seems like it, not at every opportunity, but quite often, the discussion comes up about his ultimate future in Toronto. Do you think that's something the Raptors are even actively looking at? You're always got your phone lines open. You're always waiting to see what happens. But originally, the whole idea is he is the guy. He's the replacement. Is he going to be the guy in Toronto?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think there's a future where he is a major part of an extremely successful team, as he has been in the past. As far as the quote-unquote guy, I think maybe there's six or seven of those players in the league at any given time, and there's an ebb and flow to it. But Pascal Siakam, I think his peak comes a little bit short of that. We've seen that. And that's okay, though, because those players are also rare. Pascal Siakam, despite not being one of the, you know, undeniable superstars in the league, is still extremely popular. That's why the Raptors front office, that doesn't really leak, as, you know, there's not as much water coming out of it as a lot of other front offices. Why is there a bunch of rumors about Siakam? Because he's desirable to a lot of other teams that want to add a player that puts them over the top. Now, these teams have guys who are the guy, and Pascal plugs in right next to him. But I think the Raptors, if you're going to stay in the holding pattern and give it a shot, the blueprint that they followed to get Kawhi isn't one that's easily replicated. But teams trade for stars all the time, and guys get disgruntled, like there are reports that Pascal Siakam is. And you could wait. Maybe you patch things up with Siakam, wait for him to get healthy. He recoups a lot of his value, and whether he's with the star that you try to trade for or you're trading him for assets that kind of shape how the team will be in the future, I think you wait and see. And the Raptors being able to jump into the, you know, the top end of the lottery, select a premier talent like Scottie Barnes, allows them to wait a little bit longer to see what the ceiling of the team is and to see how things shake out. But as far as, like, the number one guy, Pascal Siakam probably isn't. He could still be a top 20 player in the league.
So, Sampson, then that kind of leads to, all right, so see, I think that's a great analysis of where Siakam is. So, got that. So, the options then, if, you know, Lowry is not retained in terms of where this franchise projected, and you already said, listen, New York or nice weather, that's bang on. That's 100% the case in the NBA, and it's always going to be. But 2019, the last non-COVID season, we all know what happened. The Raptors won. They got the lightning in a bottle, whatever. Kawhi was here. It was terrific. They couldn't retain him. 2 years down the road now, we get ready for 2022. Has the perception, has the feelings of the Toronto Raptors as a destination in the NBA changed a little bit in your mind, changed exponentially? Given the fact we all agree, yes, it's not New York, it's not warm weather, but surely the winning the NBA title and the excitement of this fan base, has it changed the perception? Do you think of at least some free agents are going to say, sure, I'll go to Toronto, that's a destination now?
A certain style, a certain kind of free agent, I think. You can see it in guys who are coming off of their first contract. Let's say, like, Stanley Johnson obviously isn't having a very successful NBA career. We'll see if he gets another contract. But players of that ilk, first-rounders, lottery players that didn't get the perfect fit with their NBA team, they're looking to Toronto to kind of reclaim and enter that developmental system. NBA draft picks are much happier to be drafted to Toronto now than ever before. You can look at anybody that's been drafted there recently, and then you can compare that to Damon Stoudemire, for example, who did not want to be in Toronto despite being, you know, a talent at that young age. I don't know if the premier free agents really are sizing up the Raptors in any meaningful way. That's why we kind of have to wait for maybe Shea Gilgeous-Alexander to become a free agent and then reap the benefits of the homegrown talent. Fingers crossed, right? But I think it's a certain class of free agent, guys who have a lot of potential and view the Raptors' developmental system as a means to be the best version of themselves. And that has a lot of value in its own way. And the Raptors, the way they grow and their reputation has really, it's resonated with a certain style of player. It's not superstars. One day maybe it is, because Toronto is a great, wonderful city and a lot of people like it. It's famous and it's world-renowned. But I don't think we're at the superstar point yet. But I think there's a lot of players who wouldn't have viewed Toronto as viable that now view it as almost essential for the future of their career.
Yeah, here's hoping that's the case, because that makes business a lot easier. And the Raptors have certainly earned that. The Blue Jays went through that as well in terms of establishing themselves as a destination, winning the World Series. And it's still a battle for them, so we'll see how it shakes down. But one thing the Blue Jays and the Raptors also have in common, Sampson, and the Raptors will find out relatively soon, because my goodness, October will be here before we know it. It's already August the 1st today, is they will have the opportunity to return home. And we've talked about the Blue Jays not playing a home game in 22 months. And the fact that they're now back at Rogers Center and back in Toronto, no matter what the perception is, it's still your home park. It's your home city. And we saw the emotion Friday night when this team came back. Talk a little bit about the Raptors, because they will be next up. TFC is back playing, of course. We'll see the Leafs return in the fall. It's exciting to think about. But this Toronto team is the same thing. They have been away. They've been in the bubble. They had the road, basically a road game in Florida most nights, because although they had a quote-unquote home arena, most fans are cheering for their favorite NBA team, not the Raptors. What's it going to mean for this franchise and the players when they get their turn to finally return to Toronto?
Oh, probably just much better mental health. A guy who is really good at saying, you know, and being able to express exactly how the rigors affected his game. Fred VanVleet was an excellent quote all year in Tampa Bay and in the bubble as well. And even though he's able to speak on it eloquently and tell you this is what's happening, it didn't mean that was the antidote to all the troubles and all the difficulties that happened in Tampa Bay of trying to, you know, play basketball in a hotel ballroom. That's your practice area. You can't throw the ball too high. It might hit a chandelier, that kind of stuff. And it's tough for those guys. So coming back to Scotiabank Arena, having all of the quirks and rhythms that they remember return back to their game. You're shooting at that same rim. Even just like the statistics of role players who shoot way better at home. Pascal Siakam was a player who you can see how he responds to the fans. There's plenty of pictures of him engaging with the fans after a big basket. That's a huge part of his game. He feeds off of it. He'll have that once he's returned from his torn labrum, which he had a successful surgery on. And the team, they'll feel support. And it's been tough for, you know, there's been a lot of studies trying to quantify what a fan base does when it's in the arena. But you can see last year when they were being booed in their own arena or constantly having, you know, their fans cheer for other teams, I imagine that has some sort of toll. I couldn't quantify it. But now that that's gone and you get the inverse, I'm sure good things will happen. Plus, you get to live in your house. It's a bunch of good things all at once.
Well, yeah, and Kyle Lowry even missed driving on the Gardner. Although I'm going to tell you, when he gets back, Sampson, he's not going to miss driving on the Gardner anymore, because it's just as bad as it always was. Sampson Folk is the co-host of A Minute Basketball Podcast, joining us to talk some off-season Raptors news. Sampson, you're a good man. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Sampson Folk joining us from Minute Basketball Podcast. I'm Roger Lajoie. I'm still chuckling at Mayor Kyle Lowry. Oh, we missed driving on the Gardner. That's missing the city, okay? Shouldn't laugh, because, you know, you do. You do. And I have to admit, even driving into the ballpark on Friday, I got there super early. But, you know, traffic was pretty bad. And in and around, you know, Rogers Center, scrambling to find parking. But it's been so long since you've had to do it, it doesn't matter. However, I'm back in, and I think I score games in another 2 weeks. I'm pretty sure I'm going to be saying, what is this with this traffic? Would people move? Come on. But you don't know what you got till it's gone, eh? As the old tune goes. 590, 590 is the text line. Your comments are welcome. At the Rog 590 on Twitter. Email Roger at sportsnet590.ca. Our poll. Jay's going to make the playoffs. Yes or no? Vast majority of you say yes now with the move. Still got some work to do, but they're right there, especially just to get into that wild card spot. Dan in Burlington said he had free beer and food to start and then an unreal game. It was the best ever. That was his experience on Friday. Dan, thank you. Tim in Peterborough says the Jays are running hard. I'm glad the Canadian government gave them the wave home. Tim in Peterborough, thank you. Appreciate it. Yes, it took a lot of stuff to get them back here. And I think among all the lessons we learned during COVID and continue to learn is the different way the pandemic is handled in the United States as it is in Canada. And since the Raptors and the Jays in particular are the only Canadian franchises in a U.S.-based league, it took a lot to make this happen. And I'm not going to get into the politics of that, but end of the day is we're happy they're back. And even the hashtag, the welcome home, I thought everything about it was terrific. Derek emails in, Roger enjoying the show as always, and I have to say I was brought to tears on Friday night sitting at home here on my couch. I don't know how I feel about going back into the ballpark just yet, and I'm curious. I know you're one of the official scorers, and I'm sure you sit up high in your spot, but what did you think of how the crowd was, and is it a safe environment? Thanks, Derek. That's a great question. I was talking to technical director Josh Santos, who was in the stands at the ballpark as well on Friday night, and I was sitting in the official scorer's position. The roof is open. It is an outdoor venue. There are social distancing sections you can get if you really do want to keep away from people. But the rest of the good seats, people are right on top of each other. So my only comment with that, and it's a great question, Derek, I think everybody's degree of comfort, not just going back to the ballpark, but going back to the office and circulating, is going to be different. And if we want to avoid a fourth wave and we want to stay safe and we want to keep this going, we still have to remember there is a very serious pandemic. It is a health issue, and we still have to be smart. And I noticed even among coworkers, people are, the level of comfort is very different with a lot of people. It isn't turnkey. A siren didn't go off. Okay, pandemic's over. Everybody go out and have fun. No, you still have to operate in the same way. I thought it was safe. I didn't see any difficulty. I heard from a lot of people who were at the ballpark, and they felt that the precautions were being taken. But when you get, there was 13,994, I think the attendance was, whatever it was, in the stands at the same time, it's something we haven't seen, any of us, in 16 months. So, Derek, your degree of comfort might be a little different than other people are. And I hope the pandemic teaches us to be respectful of everybody's degree of comfort. If you had anxiety before this, and many of us do, it certainly isn't going to be easy for you to come back. So hopefully the patience is shown by everybody. Thank you for that, Derek. 590, 590 text. We'll get to the tweets, I promise you, at the Rog 590 shortly. And you can email Roger at sportsnet590.ca. Dennis Bernstein coming up. He is at the fourth period and at SiriusXM. What a week already. An NHL free agency. We'll recap it with him in moments. I'm Roger Lajoie, Sportsnet today on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone.
Sportsnet today in the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Roger Lajoie here until 1 o'clock. Blue Jay baseball is coming up. Game 3 of the 3-game series, Jays against Kansas City Royals. Coming off a beauty by Alex Manoa yesterday, Jays look to sweep the series today, and we'll have full coverage for you. Jays talk right after the game, as always, with Rob Wong and Josh Goldberg. Ian Hunter will talk more Blue Jays with us at the top of the next hour. Lee Hamilton will talk to us about MLB. right now. Joining us to talk about NHL and NHL free agency, which opened this week, Dennis Bernstein. He's the co-host of the Kings of the Podcast and senior writer at The Fourth Period. Dennis, always great to have you on the show. Hope you're safe and well, my friend. And yes, very, very busy free agency week, a lot of signings. But one of the big elephants in the room remains Jack Eichel and the Buffalo Sabres. What are you hearing on that front, Dennis?
Raj, it's deteriorating by the minute, I think. When you look at the statements put out by the Sabres, and then the agents go to the social media and say that the process isn't working, there's a rumor now that if the Sabres retain 50% of the deal, it could be he could be going to the Rangers. Something's got to come to a head, Raj. I don't know how you could be comfortable if you're an organization having Jack Eichel in camp for the Buffalo Sabres. I think that at some point in time here in August, you have to basically put in a deadline and say, look, there's still interested parties. And I'm not sure, Roger, are a lot of interested parties left. That might be part of the issue. You got to set a deadline and say, look, we're starting camp on the 14th. We need a deal done. Plus, you have to make a decision on the medical. I mean, that's the thing that's holding everything up. You look at the statements made by the two Peters, the agents for Jack Eichel, and saying there's been no resolution on what the next step is. So it's been very, very messy. They have to unmess it. They have to unclutter this and just decide to move on from this player because it's just it's never going to be a good situation with Jack Eichel in Buffalo. So cut your losses, make the deal, have the surgery done, and let's everyone move on.
It's a tough situation indeed, and it's festered for so long. That's the best word, Dennis, that the Sabres have put themselves in a real bind in terms of this. It's obviously a premier player, and making that deal is getting tougher by the minute when you see this stuff. So we shall see. So much happened in the last week. Recapping, though, let's start with Seattle and the expansion draft. They passed on Carey Price, but they get Grubauer. Do you think Seattle, that was really the intent all along for them, or was there any gamesmanship there? And what did you think of the job that Ron Francis and company did? It was a very different expansion draft as opposed to what we saw with the Golden Knights 4 years ago.
I'll tell you one thing. Ronnie Francis made Mark Bergevin sweat. I mean, there was a possibility that they were going to take Carey Price. He is from the Pacific Northwest, so there would have been some hometown joy over that. But, Raj, when you look at that, I think it's an $11 million roster bonus that he gets in September. Like, Seattle wasn't going in that direction. You look at all the other high-priced players they passed on. They could have had a Jake Voracek or a Ryan Johansson or a Matt Duchene. So I didn't see that option available. I think from a financial standpoint, they don't want to do that. With respect to Grubauer, there's one thing very obvious, Raj, right? They're building from the back end out, right? They've got now Grubauer and Chris Driedger. They drafted some nice defensemen. They signed some nice and Jamie Oleksiak. You know, the question is, can they score? Now, they got Jaden Schwartz, but their number one center was going to be Yanni Gourde. He's out with shoulder surgery until November. So, again, I think the same questions we asked about Vegas 4 years ago, can they score? I'm going to ask the same questions of Seattle. To me, that's the flaw in this team, is that they're going to have to be way better offensively to get in the mix. Now, some people think they can make the postseason because the Pacific Division is clearly the weakest in the NHL. I don't really see it that way yet. They'd have to get some masterful offensive performances to think they can compete for a top three, because I don't think they're going to be a wild card in that Pacific Division.
Trouble scoring is something a lot of teams have, and a lot of teams obviously need a defenseman because the premium for defensemen rising all the time. Seth Jones headed to Chicago, Dougie Hamilton to New Jersey. Are we going to see the trend, Dennis? You know, because it's interesting. We go in cycles in hockey, and we're seeing it now. I think a trend now is, you know, better have two experienced goaltenders, and you're going to have to pay more for that backup because the waivers and everything, expansion had something to do with it. That's a trend. But one trend that never ends is you can never have enough defensemen, and that seems to be the case. Talk about maybe Jones and the Chicago situation to me is interesting, Dennis. Like, what are the Blackhawks exactly? Where do they see themselves now in terms of their development? How quickly they can become a better team? It's been a tough couple of years.
Yeah, Raj. Well, we can talk about a pandemic, but you know, the NHL handed out $975 million in contracts between free agents and extensions. So I'm saying, like, pandemic what? Like, the expectation that everybody's going to be in the building. Chicago, I got to think that Chicago looks themselves as a playoff team, Raj. You make those moves, you give big money and big term to Seth Jones. That's what you got to, the expectation is. You know, Jonathan Taves is going to be back. So that's a big ad. So I think at this point in time, Marc-Andre Fleury, like, they're going for it. And then Lekkonen, the rookie, he had a decent season. But when you're being in the Vezina winner and he wants to play now, you see Chicago tweeted just a little bit, going emoji of a flower. So the expectation is that Marc-Andre Fleury is going to be there. I think the expectation in Chicago is going to be a playoff team. I'm not sure they get there, but I think with the spectator. And remember, they added Tyler Johnson for the Brent Seabrook contract. So the top six looks pretty decent. You know, Kirby Dach, DeBrincat, Kane, Kubalik, Taves and Tyler Johnson. That's quality. I think they think they're not going to win that division, but I think they can get back to the playoffs this season. That's certainly what they're going for right now.
Vegas Golden Knights have been an absolutely tremendous success story in their 4 years. I guess it's, what, seven playoff series that they've won in 4 years. Disappointing from their standpoint to lose to the Habs this year, but end of the day, they've been great. So I got to ask you, what do you think of the whole Fleury situation and the entire way, Dennis, that Vegas has done business, despite all that great success? They've already been through two coaches. They've had numerous roster changes. Yeah. Clearly, they're not a team that likes to stand pat, and they continue to make moves. They deserve full credit. It's been an absolute home run off and on the ice. I don't mean that as a criticism, but it's certainly an interesting way of doing business. And even the whole Fleury thing left a kind of bad taste in people's mouths.
Well, if you're a Vegas Golden Knight fan and you want aggressiveness from your front office, you got it. Without question, you got aggressiveness. But the question is, Roger, is that our players really want to come? Are they going to want to come here in the future, given the way that Marc-Andre Fleury was treated, given the way that they traded away Ryan Reeves, who was a heart and soul player, right? They traded away a guy like Nick Holden, who was a really quality guy, and a guy like Nate Schmidt 2 seasons ago, who was a heart and soul. A lot of these heart and soul players have gone. I guess they look at it as a business. They want to put together the best roster they can, and with respect to chemistry and glue and team building, I don't think they put that at a premium. Could that come back to bite them in the future? It could, but they still have Mark Stone and Mats Pacioretty and William Karlsson and Jonathan Marchessault and Alec Martinez and Pietrangelo and Shea Theodore. So I'm not feeling sorry for them. I think that when things get tough in a playoff series, not to have that glue guys in the room, that might cost them. Look, I would have traded Robin Leonard and kept Marc-Andre Fleury. I just love the player. He won the Vezina. He's a leader on this team. But, Raj, when you saw against the Montreal Canadiens, when Robin Leonard started the elimination game, I said, well, they're not going to go with $12 million in net again this next season. So, to me, that was the writing on the wall. Clearly, Robin Leonard is Peter DeBoer's guy. I think without question. In big games, he started, despite, you know, you had the Vezina winner on the bench for an elimination game. I think that tells the tale. So it's very curious. They're going to be one of the Cup favorites again, but will they have the chemistry to win the Stanley Cup? I'm not sure at this point.
Yeah, Fleury in particular, interesting, when you look back down, same kind of situation as time ending in Pittsburgh, the way it ended there, and the same kind of thing in Vegas. And he's a Hall of Fame goaltender, and he won the Vezina, and he's won multiple Stanley Cups. But, boy, his exits from the two places he's been has been fascinating, to say the least. Do you have a winners losers kind of reflection? There's still a lot of time in the offseason. A lot is going to get said and done. We, as I mentioned at the top of our conversation, the Eichel situation is a big domino to fall. But who do you think's really benefited so far, and who do you think figures to be substantially or at least somewhat better this year than they were last year based on the activity to date, Dennis?
Well, Raj, up until like 3 days ago, I think Boston had a great offseason. I really did. They added Ullmark, and you can debate about him. They added Foligno, Haller, Forbert. They re-signed Riley. They brought back Hall. I thought it was great. But then David Krejci made the decision to go back to the Czech Republic to play, to finish out his career. I think that's a major, major hole for Tusi. I would suspect that, and I know they talked to them before, but I think they're going to go back to Arizona and maybe talk about Christian Dvorak. Right now, Charlie Coyle is their 2C. He's not a 2C. In their mix, he's a 3C, so they really need to address that hole. So I like what they did. I think Seattle put together a representative roster with respect to, they won't embarrass themselves. I think the over-under for the point total for them is 65, so it tells you they're going to win maybe 27, 28 games. At least Vegas thinks that way. So I think that team did well. And I like what Edmonton did. You know, their blue line's going to look different, right? And you can debate Duncan Keith, at $5.5 million. But the way I look at Duncan Keith and Edmonton, Rogers, you're paying $2 million for basically a third-pair defenseman at this point. You're paying $3.5 million for leadership in the room. And that's the one thing that this team lacked. So when I look at Edmonton, what they did, yeah, you could question the Ethan Bear trade, but I think the way they've reconstituted their defense, because that's what they need to do, I think they've improved on the blue line. They do need to extend Darnell Nurse. He's owed a contract. He's unrestricted after this year. But adding Duncan Keith, adding Cody Ceci, bringing in Zach Hyman, they're clearly the second best team in the Pacific right now. Is that enough to get them past, let's say, a Vegas in the postseason? I'm not sure. But I think they've made the smart right moves with respect to what they've done with the defense and adding Zach up front.
How about the Maple Leafs, who have made moves, and they bring in Peter Mrazek to help out Jack Campbell. Anderson goes to Carolina in kind of a flop of city of goaltenders, and they have more bodies, and they're still a work in progress. But they basically decided, despite the fact that they did not succeed in the playoffs again, it's going to be the core four. Those guys are going to do it, and they're going to live and die by those guys. What do you think?
Yeah, well, you don't like Marco Bunting on the fourth line? Just kidding, Raj. I think that, look, right, here's the thing, right? If they were to win a round, wouldn't that be progression for this team? Like, because they haven't changed, Roger. The face of the team has changed. Nothing's going to change. The style isn't going to change. The players really, in essence, haven't changed. They swapped out a couple of old guys for a couple of younger guys, right? You know, but to me, like, if they would win a round, technically it's progression, like, especially coming off what they did against the Canadiens in the first round. So I is this team a Stanley Cup contender? I don't think so. I think when push comes to shove, they would have to prove it, Roger. They'd have to walk through the fires that they've never walked through. So to me, a talented team, they'll be a fun team, they'll get 100 points, and then I've got major questions about it. Can they do it in the postseason? That's all this team is about. So I think that they're rolling the dice again with basically the same cast of characters. But, Roger, I think we'll get to the truth of this team next summer. Like, what happens this season? Like, do they make a deep run? If you do, then you keep the core together. If you don't, then you've got to make substantial changes. You can't make the cosmetic changes they've made by swapping out basically Peter Mrazek for Freddie Anderson for Peter Mrazek. So I think the tale will be told this season. If you go through another season like you did last, where there's no playoff success, then you really have to shift the paradigm to a different type of team.
Yeah, and got to make the playoffs first. It might be a bigger challenge this year too, because a lot of teams are improving. So that's the interesting thing about the Leafs and the Habs, Dennis, to be honest with you. I think we'll see qualifying for the playoffs, never mind winning a playoff series. Next year will be interesting. Final question, we'll let you go. We look at COVID, and as you mentioned, you know, NHL teams spending a pile of money, even though we're up against a cap. So the general consensus of most teams is that business will return and fans will be back and they'll get up to snuff. But because of this cap crunch situations that's there, do you ever see a time maybe the NHL, instead of operating on this hard cap, and I know it's probably more of a labor situation, but would they ever look at a luxury tax or a softer kind of a cap situation moving forward? Because clearly there are a whole pile of teams in this league that like to spend more money if they could.
Well, Roger, I think that when we get to after the flat cap goes away with the new TV contracts chipping in from ESPN and TNT, I think you're going to see a substantial move in the salary cap. So I think I don't think they have the appetite to change the structure. You hear everybody crying about Tampa Bay and $18 million over the cap. I don't think there's any appetite to do that. They'd have to collectively bargain it to begin with. I don't think the Islanders would push back hard on it. And remember, for the people say you want to abolish the cap, you know, the salary cap, well, there's a cap floor too, Raj. And the danger is if you want to change this system – and they say, okay, there's no more cap ceiling, then I'm sure the owners are going to say, okay, there's going to be no cap floor, and you go run into a situation like baseball has.
Yeah, bottom teams, they're not spending any money.
Yeah, the bottom teams are going to spend, like, you know, Arizona would spend $25 million. They got to spend at least $60. So it's a slippery slope here, Raj. I'm satisfied with it. I love the balance in this league where you can have a team like, you know, a small market like Nashville compete. Like, to me, that's important. So for all the people that say, okay, there shouldn't be a cap, well, there's a floor, and you got to remember that, and that would hurt the players as well, because you could have teams playing 23 guys, $2 million or $1 million a year, and you don't want that either, and the competitive balance would not be there despite some people saying that. So I don't think a luxury tax is in the appetite, because I don't think we want the major market teams. I like the way it is. I like when we go to the playoffs and there's 16 teams and we say, hey, 8 could win the Stanley Cup. I love that, and I don't think the league wants to, you know, change that one bit.
Yeah, maybe it's closer to 12, never mind 8, Dennis. You're right about that.
Yeah,
Dennis,
right?
Dennis Bernstein is co-host of the Kings of the Podcast, senior writer at the Fourth Period, joining us to talk about start of NHL free agency. Dennis, always great to have you on the show. Thanks so much, my friend.
A great pleasure being with you on Fan 590, Raj. Thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Dennis Bernstein joining us from the fourth period. Great stuff there. Great stuff has come in on Twitter. Your feedback on the Blue Jays. Our poll on Twitter is, do you think the Blue Jays are going to be in the playoffs this year? Yes or no? Vast majority of you so far saying yes. And I'd like your thoughts, your emotions, your comments from Friday night's game. We've had some terrific people and comments weigh in. We'll read those for you and keep them coming, folks, because Friday night was a special night. You don't know what you got till it's gone, and it's back. And the Jays came home, and it was an emotional, terrific evening. Some of you are going to share your thoughts here in a moment. Sportsnet Today continues. I'm Roger Lajoie on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Today on the Sportsnet Radio Network, I'm Roger Lajoie until Blue Jay baseball comes, and that's 1 o'clock. First pitch just after 1:07. So far, 67.1% of you vote in our Twitter poll say yes, the Blue Jays will make the playoffs. 32.9% say no, they will not make the playoffs. Your thoughts and comments are welcome. Sue, regular texter. Sue, always nice to hear from you, says the team is better than their record at this point, and things will reflect it soon. They surely can't lose as many close bullpen games moving forward. It's going to be all uphill, I see. Sue, thank you. I would largely agree with that, Sue, almost completely. I really do. And, you know, we talk about stats and breaking it down and probability and strength of schedule and everything else. The run differential stat, in my mind, is never, nothing is a guarantee of success. But when a team is that good in run differential, and you look at the Jays and the Yankees, and the gap is wide, even though the Yankees still have a game lead on the Blue Jays, doesn't mean that it's guaranteed that the Blue Jays are going to finish ahead of the Yankees, to use that as an example. But it just means perhaps there's more underlying reasons to believe that the Jays will be better than the Yankees as we go down the stretch here. And that's one of the teams are going to have to be better than to make the playoffs. So I would agree. And I think those things even out. And when you see return to health and you see yesterday Romano coming in, I think Brad Hand is a nice addition. And if they can get everybody in that bullpen healthy, they've had so many injuries back there. They're back home in Toronto, that emotional lift, improved pitching, another stud starter they've added. Yeah, you put all that together, I think it's fair to say that it should be uphill the rest of the season. Is it going to be enough to close the gap, get a playoff spot? We'll see, but I don't see any way the Blue Jays are going to be worse. Let's put it that way. Great opportunity ahead. Thank you. Daryl says, honestly, no. Have they improved their roster? Yes, I think they needed a catching upgrade, but I'm nitpicking there. There's just too many teams to overtake and 60 games to do it. Nobody knows for sure, but we can't say this team isn't exciting to watch. Daryl, thank you. They are very exciting to watch, which may be where some of the optimism comes. Maybe teams that are as fun as the Blue Jays, who bash the ball like the Blue Jays, make you feel better about watching them, and they're exciting, and you think, sure, they can make it because they're exciting. Baseball comes down to pitching again. Do they have enough pitching? But I say now they do. With the additions, I think they do, especially augmented by this lineup. And the too many teams to catch, 60 games to overtake, I don't agree with that, Daryl. I think over 60 games, that's more than enough time to get on a run. It's still within your grasp. When you're down to, you know, 2 weeks to go in the season and you need teams to win or lose, and the too many teams to stay ahead of or catch up on, they're a game back of the Yankees. They're a handful of games back of Seattle and Oakland. And that's it. So I think they can do it. I think there's more than enough time for them to make a run down the stretch here. And we shall see. And Daryl, thank you, and you stay well. Great to hear from you. Other comments here. Chris, talking about her Friday night experience. Chris lives in Florida. And Chris, thank you for your tweet. Watch from Tampa and super excited. Today, watching Jose Berrios pitch is even more exciting. Sign him, Rogers, and sign Vladdy, too. Atlanta and San Diego signed their stars to big dollars. Let's do it. My parents will give a dollar extra in their Rogers bill. Thanks, Chris. I'll pass that on. Yes, ultimately, re-signing the core players. Yeah. And certainly Vladdy, Bichette, to a certain extent Biggio, but especially Vladdy and Bichette, are going to cost a mint. And we saw Atlanta and San Diego. That's the model. Keep those guys. But as far as this particular season goes, I think they're in great shape. We shall see. Kathy, talking about Friday night's game on Twitter, says, "We were there. Many people around us were crying for the opening ceremony. I was just happy to be back. It meant so much more than just baseball. It was a little tiny bit of normal. I shed a tear or two. It was awesome." Kathy, hard to follow that. Thank you. Great tweet. Derek tweets in and says, "Just a sense of normalcy of being back, seeing how the players were excited to be back and having the feeling of this, plus the deadline pickups, giving the team a shot in the arm it needs to go on a run, made it very exciting and very special." Derek, thank you. Fred tweets in and says, "I had tears in my eyes as I approached the dome. I had tears in my eyes as the players took the field, but it was all cheering once the ump said, play ball." Fred, thank you. "Sense of normalcy coming back and the dignified and terrific way the Blue Jays did it were all part of a memorable experience for any of us who had the opportunity to be in the ballpark or watching on TV. It really was a special night. And welcome home, Blue Jays. We are in for a fun couple of months." And I say they're going to make the playoffs. And can you imagine how much fun that would be? At the Rog 590, we'll continue to read your tweets. Email Roger at sportsnet590.ca. You can text the show 590-590. Name and location, please, if you are texting. Speaking of those Blue Jays, Ian Hunter is a lead baseball writer at the Daily Hive Toronto. We'll preview today's game with Ian, talk about the Jays' chances of getting into the playoffs and how they close that gap in moments. I'm Roger Lajoie. Good Sunday, everybody. Thanks for listening to Sportsnet Today. We're on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
It all happens in real time. Don't be the last to know. Listen here first. Sportsnet Today on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Today on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Roger Lajoie with you here until 1 o'clock. The boys are indeed back in town as the Blue Jays take on the Kansas City Royals. First pitch flies around 107 from Rogers Center today. Ben Wagner has the call right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. We'll have Blue Jays talk right after the game, so stick around. A lot of excitement with this team. Moves made at the trade deadline. Lots of fun. We are in for an exciting couple of months. Weigh in on Twitter at the Rog 590. Text 590-590. Name and location. Email Roger at sportsnet590.ca. Always terrific to hear from you. We'll read all your comments between now and 1 o'clock. We'll get some comments now from Ian Hunter. He's the lead baseball writer at Daily Hive Toronto as the Jays get ready to take on the Royals. Ian, thanks very much for being with us. Your description of what we saw on Friday night after 670 days, this team comes back home, and it was some kind of an experience, wasn't it?
For sure. I mean, and one word to describe it is probably surreal. It's been almost 2 years since the Blue Jays have been in Toronto. And I think even just, you know, whether you're a fan, you're a writer, or just a casual observer, I mean, I think you couldn't help but kind of get choked up at just watching that ceremony. It was really pretty emotional just to kind of see the players running down the middle of the field there with Charlie Montoyo leading the way, and even see, you saw him get choked up a little bit. And I think Bo Bichette said many of the players were fighting back tears. And although, you know, the Blue Jays did their very best as they could in Dunedin and Buffalo, there's really nothing like being back in Toronto, and just that atmosphere over the last couple of days is very reminiscent of kind of 2015, 2016. I realize there's only 15,000 fans there, but it certainly sounded like 35, 40,000 fans. It's just been really just fun to watch fans back in the place that they call home, and same for the players.
Well, without question, and, you know, it's been a difficult time, Ian. You know, 670 days without a home game, is you talk about surreal. That number, when it hits you like that, makes you realize what a difficult thing it was. And the players seem to feed off that. And Ian, I don't think there's any question that this team is going to feed off the fact that they're, you know, got some home cooking, that are back in Toronto. So that's a factor. But probably the biggest thing is with Jose Berrios now, they've got three very reliable starters. Hand adds to the bullpen. Some degree of health returning to the bullpen is certainly going to happen here in the last 60 games. This team is much better positioned now to get on the kind of run they're going to need to get on, Ian, to make the playoffs, right?
For sure. And this is going to be a really crucial stretch. And now all of a sudden they have these reinforcements that they didn't have before. They've basically rebuilt their bullpen on the fly, which was their undoing there in the month of May and June. And they've got a middle of the rotation starter in Berrios. And, you know, Corey Dickerson's, it sounds like he's on the mend as well. Someone who's going to contribute off the bench and bring a little bit of left-handed balance to this lineup. And I know it's always, this team always draws a lot of comparisons to the 2015 club, just because they really had a really great run differential in the first half of the season. And they were kind of scuffling around the 500 mark. And it's almost the same. Like, I'm really thinking back to that first start that David Price made in Toronto. I think it was Civic Holiday Monday. And here we are the day before that, and Berrios is making his Blue Jays debut in Toronto. So there's a lot of parallels there. Obviously two completely different teams, but it makes for a really, really exciting second half of the season. You know, you're thankful that the Blue Jays didn't tear things down and try to get what the best assets they could for guys like Robbie Ray and Marcus Semien. They actually loaded up and they're definitely going for it this year.
Well, and yeah, kudos to him for doing that. And your analogy of Price is bang on, because I remember being in the ballpark when that deal was made, and just everybody's walking taller. I mean, even the PR department has got they're smiling. It just made a significance that, you know, we're trying to do something here. Now, Price was in the zone then. He was 10-1 after he got here. He's one of the best baseball pitchers around. But Jose Berrios, although not of that ilk where Price was back in 2015, is a great addition too, is he not, in terms of just you're looking for that extra arm, somebody you can really feel confident in. And especially, Ian, when we talk about the bullpen, one of the biggest reasons they, you know, blew so many games in the early portion of the season was, well, first of all, guys were pitching in high leverage situations that shouldn't have, largely because of injuries, and they were overtaxed and overused. This is another guy who can chew up innings the way Alex Manoah did yesterday.
For sure. I mean, outside of Max Scherzer, I would say that Berrios was probably the best arm that any team got at the trade deadline. He had some of his best career numbers last year, and he seems to be trending upwards. You know, he's hitting that peak for starting pitchers, right? Like, right, he's age 27, already a two-time All-Star. He leads the AL in innings pitched since 2017. He's actually trimmed his walk rate a little bit this year as well. So, you also wonder what maybe if Pete Walker can kind of sprinkle some of his magic pitching dust on Berrios as well, kind of similarly to how they've done with Robbie Ray. And also the fact that Berrios is here for next year as well, that means the Blue Jays don't have to do as much heavy lifting in the offseason when they're looking in the starting pitching market. So, you know, maybe he's not a number one, but certainly a nice number two or number three to complement Hyunjin Ryu and Robbie Ray at the moment.
100% right there. Ian Hunter is with us, lead baseball writer, Daily Hive Toronto. I'm Roger Lajoie. Jays and Royals finish up the series at first pitch 107 coming up here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. So, Ian, is this now a case of with the team back here in Toronto, do you feel that this team is now good enough to make the playoffs? That's a question we've been asking on Twitter. There's a hole to dig out of. There are still the Yankees, Oakland, Seattle in the mix. Not going to be easy, and I'm kind of, you know, almost conceding that Boston and Tampa Bay, with the gap they have on the Jays, 8 and 7 games ahead of them, might be too much to come back. But there's still plenty of time for this team to make a run.
For sure. I mean, as you said, the division title is maybe a little too far out of reach. It's difficult to see the Blue Jays kind of running the table and catching up to teams like Tampa Bay or Boston. But most certainly, you know, they're currently sitting, I think, like 3 games out of a wild card spot. They just need to catch basically the Oakland A's. At last check, I think I looked at their playoff odds this morning. It's around, you know, 33% to 38%, depending on what projection model you look at. And yeah, I would say things are definitely trending upwards. The fact that they've reinforced their bullpen. They brought in another starter. George Springer seems to be hitting his stride right at the perfect moment. And they have one of the best lineups in the American League. You certainly seem to think that they're going to make things pretty close. I mean, it's, as I said, the division title is tough, but certainly a wild card spot. It's catchable, and they have a ton of games left to play before the end of the season.
Yeah, and that probability too. I've never really subscribed to a lot of that, Ian, because you know, like anything, it's based on past performance. And past situations. This is a different team. It's a different makeup. It's got a different roster. They've added another pitcher. So to try to equate everything that we've seen happen and try to project it, I think it's almost impossible, especially after the trade deadline, because there's no way to account how much better they'll be. They added to the bullpen. What'd you think of those additions? Because in addition to a new starting pitcher, that's obviously going to make a big difference.
For sure. Brad Hand's probably the big addition there. You're getting late inning relief help, someone who's traditionally been a really durable reliever, I think dating back to like 2016, 2017, a nice left-handed option for Charlie Montoyo to use. And also kind of supplements with, I mean, Ryan Borucki was having a really great stretch there for a little while, but he's scuffled as of late since coming back. So you basically upgrade there in terms of high leverage lefties, and Hand has closing experience over the last little while, and Joaquin Soria, a veteran reliever as well. And I think we even saw on Friday night that Adam Simber coming in, striking out four batters in a row. It's just all of this, you rewind like 6 months ago and things look so dire in the bullpen. And now all of a sudden, I mean, they don't have one of the best relief corps in all of baseball, but I would say it's pretty formidable, and definitely, especially if Jordan Romano can kind of turn things around. He's had a really up and down season this year. Just bring in veteran relievers who have been there before, who have pitched in the playoffs, and they know what to expect. Having that experience sometimes is priceless. So the fact that they got some veteran relief help, guys who've been there before, been in the playoffs, they know what it takes, certainly is going to help these younger relievers in the bullpen.
Yeah, and there's a lot more depth than there was. There's no doubt about that. So what did you think? I mean, you know, it came with a price, you know, in particular. I mean, Austin Martin and Richardson, those are guys that were number two and number four prospects in this organization. So it was a steep price. It's easy to get excited. And there is another year of contract controllability for, you know, the pitcher they bring in. But I don't know. Your thoughts, Ian? Like, some people suggest that maybe that was a little bit too much.
Yeah, I think looking at this particular Blue Jays front office, I think that's probably the steepest price they've had to pay in terms of prospect capital when making a trade. And yeah, you know, people were comparing this trade to the Dodgers trade for getting Scherzer and Turner. You know, you're getting Scherzer for the rest of the season and Turner for another year. I think the Blue Jays could have made that trade, but their need is not a shortstop. It's that starting pitcher. So having Berríos there for that extra year means you're going to be parting with big names. And, I think it's fun. Like, it's very rare where you see a team turn around a year after they draft their first rounder and send them off. But maybe that tells us what the Blue Jays think about the evaluation on Austin Martin. I mean, he only has two homers and about 50-some-odd games in Double-A this year, and he's bounced around between center field and shortstop. And that probably lined up for the Twins because maybe they're thinking that they won't be able to re-sign Byron Buxton. I mean, they were trying to ship him off the deadline, so now they've got a potential future center fielder in Austin Martin. But I think when it comes to prospects, you know, you hang on tightly, let go lightly. Like, there's other guys always coming up through the pipeline. The Blue Jays still have one of the strongest farm systems in baseball, even after dealing Austin Martin and Simeon Woods Richardson. And there's tons of guys behind them, Jordan Groshans, Alek Manoah in the pitching department, and you still have Nate Pearson as well. So no shortage of options. It's going to sting a little bit, but you got to give up talent to get talent.
There's no doubt about that, Ian, and that's one of the things when people criticize. Yes, you don't treat it lightly. You understand that you're giving up a lot to get the premier player, but end of the day, if you feel you got to go all in, you've got to give some value up. And I like the deal. I'm willing to live with that. And prospects are prospects. Some turn out great and others not so much, and we shall see. So got to ask you a little bit then, because, you know, when we talk about the Blue Jays playoff prospectus, you really got to look at around the rest of the league, and a lot of teams made a lot of moves, including in the Blue Jays division. The New York Yankees clearly still think they've got a crack at it this year. Boston also, Tampa Bay, doing what they can do given their restrictions. And now Tampa Bay is a first-place team by a half a game. What did you think of how the rest of the American League operated? And I know it's kind of a blanket statement, Ian, because there were so many moves made, but the Blue Jays weren't the only team buying, that's for sure.
No, I think if we had to, like, grade out which teams maybe did the best at the trade deadline, I probably would have put the Yankees up there. You're getting two premier players in Joey Gallo and Anthony Rizzo. And I think in comparison to the Blue Jays, they would have loved to have Joey Gallo in the outfield, you know, bringing some left-handed thump to the lineup. And he's one of the best defenders and outfield defenders in all of baseball. So they certainly would have loved to have him. I think that's probably the Blue Jays' strongest competition for the wild card at this point is the Yankees. You know, the Mariners, they may have made an incremental gain by trading Kendall Graveman, and then they get Diego Castillo from the Rays. But I mean, if you're looking at the Rays, right, like they traded away their closer, and then, yeah, as you said, they all of a sudden they leapt into first place. I mean, it defies logic, but that's kind of how the Tampa Bay Rays operate at this point. And the Red Sox reinforced their team a little bit, but I'd say overall the Yankees probably made the biggest splashes, and they've got the prospect capital. They have the ability to take on payroll. So that's a team that's always if they're within a sniff of the playoffs, it seems like they're always very active at the trade deadline.
Yes, they do not stand pat. There's no rebuilds in New York, and we'll see how they do it. And I guess, too, you know, Ian, we were talking earlier about, playoff probability, projections and what have you. Still the most incredible stat. And again, if you're into run differential and you know, you say what you want about it, but when you look throughout Major League Baseball, it just stands out so much that the Blue Jays have a plus 103 run differential, which is one of the best in the American League, and they're in fourth place in the division, and they're chasing the Yankees, who are minus two. And I know, like, it goes back and forth. Okay, so run differential is one team's got 95, the other team has 46, and the gap doesn't mean, and sometimes it's blow. I get all that. But that is just startling, and it's just such an almost, you know, indication of that even though there's only 60 games left in a 162-game season, if that trend continues, the team with that kind of a run differential has got to start winning some ball games that the kind of games that they lost in the first part of the season.
Yeah, ultimately, I think what it boils down to when you look at a stat like run differential is that the talent is there, obviously, especially on the lineup side when it comes to Blue Jays. You know, they're plus 103. The Mariners are minus 55 in run differential. They're basically outperforming their record more than anybody in baseball, and the Blue Jays are underperforming more than any other team in baseball, and yet they're only about a game apart in the wild card standings. So, yeah, it's you would think over the course of a 162-game schedule, things even out. Luck will bounce the way of the Blue Jays because they have had some tough luck losses in the first half. I mean, every team does, but it kind of seems like the Blue Jays bullpen melted down more often than not for a six-week stretch there. But, yeah, you figure the fact that you've got a really strong lineup, an MVP candidate in Vladimir Guerrero Jr., George Springer coming back into form, and you're adding another premier starting pitcher to this lineup, I would say on paper you really like their odds. I would say it's almost better than 30% to make the playoffs for here on out for the Blue Jays.
I would definitely agree with that. We'll see if they can do it. Blue Jays close out their first series at Rogers Center in their coming home weekend against the Kansas City Royals at 1 o'clock. Ben Wagner has a call right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Jays talk coming up right after the game with Rob Wong and Josh Goldberg. Ian Hunter is the lead baseball writer at Daily Hive Toronto. Ian, thanks so much for your time, pal.
Thank you, Roger. Take care.
You too. Ian Hunter joining us from Daily Hive Toronto. I'm Roger Lajoie. So the Jays sit at 53-48, 8 games back of Tampa Bay, 7.5 back of Boston, because Tampa Bay moved into first place last night with their win over the Red Sox, and a game back of the Yankees, who have won two straight as well, who made some major moves. But as far as the wild card goes, never mind the division. So 8 games back of Tampa, 7.5 back of Boston. That's with 60 games to go. That's a hill to climb. But the Jays are now just 3.5 back of the wild card. And in terms of the number of teams they have to catch, it's Seattle, Yankees, and Oakland. Oakland's currently with that second wild card spot. That's not that many. And I've heard people comment, you know, some of the comments we've had earlier as well, the Jays have too many teams ahead of them. That's not a lot of teams. And especially considering the fact they'll play the Yankees down the stretch. It's there. It's there for them. That's why they decided to make the moves they did. They're a much better ball club than they were before the trade deadline. And we'll see if they're going to be good enough to make the playoffs. The majority of you on Twitter so far say, yes, they are good enough to make the playoffs. The moves have convinced you, and that's the vote so far. A couple of more comments. Caroline Frolick, who's one of a great hosts at Sportsnet 650, tweeted in and said she was in Vancouver watching, bawling like a baby. Caroline, Allah, you were not alone in that. It was an emotional night for a lot of people. You stay well, Caroline. Great to hear from you. Dix tweets in and says, I was in New Brunswick jumping up and down, and his hashtags are the love, or icons are the love of baseball. And Dix, 100%. It is so true, isn't it, when there are certain sports that bring out emotion. They all do. We're seeing it in the Olympics. All sports bring out emotion. But there is something about the emotional attachment that diehard baseball fans have to their half of their sport that supersedes just about any other sport I can think of. It really is remarkable. Thanks for your comments. Text 590-590. We've got a few more. We'll read them later in the show. You can also reach us on Twitter at TheRaj590 or email roger@sportsnet590.ca. We'll get your views right up until 1 o'clock. Coming up, however, it's time to talk to Lee Hamilton. He's legendary sports talk show host in San Diego. We'll talk to him about how the teams out west performed at the trade deadline, because there are a lot of good teams. How good are Oakland and Seattle? Are the Blue Jays now better and leapfrogging them? And my goodness, the Dodgers continue to do everything to catch the Giants. How are the Giants hanging on? We'll talk about that in moments. Sportsnet Today continues. I'm Roger Lejoie on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet Today, Sportsnet Radio Network. Roger Lejoie with you till the top of this next hour as Blue Jay Baseball takes the airwaves. And Ben Wagner in the booth from Rogers Center will bring you the call of today's game. Great to hear Ben's voice back on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Great to have the team back in an emotional and wonderful Friday night. It was. Yesterday was great, too, and I'm sure today will be great. And I'm sure every game will be great because so many people will be at their first game back since the pandemic. It's been a long 22 months since the Blue Jays were back in town, and that's going to make a difference for this team, along with their acquisitions at the trade deadline. I say that makes them a playoff team. What say you? At the Raj 590 is where you find the poll. You can also comment there. You can text 590-590 with your name and your location, or email roger@sportsnet590.ca. We'll read them between now and 1 o'clock. Lots of other teams in Major League Baseball making moves, including the teams in California. And there are four California teams that think they're going to be playoff teams. In fact, they have every reason to think they're going to be playoff teams. They very well should be. Lee Hamilton joins us. Longtime radio voice in San Diego. LeeHacksawHamilton.com is his website. Lee, good morning. Always great to have you on the show, my friend. And let's talk about just the whole Major League Baseball trade deadline. Pandemic or no, wow, there was a lot of activity, Lee, and a lot of teams were not afraid to make significant moves.
Yeah, Raj, good afternoon in Canada. The out-of-town scoreboard reads 37 trades made at the baseball trading deadline. Included in that group that were shuttled to other teams were 10 All-Stars, a wide variety of guys who were headed to free agency that clubs just felt they could not re-sign, a phenomenal number of acquisitions. And as the dominoes started to fall, the rumors were just unbelievable that the Yankees were going to not trade for pitching, but they were going to trade for the two left-handed bats that they got in Joey Gallo and Anthony Rizzo. the bidding war out on the West Coast between the Dodgers, the Padres, and the Giants for Max Scherzer. At one point on Friday afternoon, it looked like Scherzer was coming to the Padres on a rental. 5 hours later, he was going to the Dodgers along with the all-star shortstop Trey Turner. And the deals just kept coming at an unbelievable pace, so much so that when the deadline ended at 1 o'clock, they still had 8 more trades they had yet to announce. I've never seen it in baseball like this. It's probably a combination of the pandemic, the luxury tax issues that a lot of clubs have, the cash flow issues, the fact that not everybody has recovered from, you know, locked out stadiums and things like that from last summer's pandemic, and the fact that they've eliminated the waiver period between August 1st and September 1st, where you could still make side deals to get guys on waivers. You can't do that anymore. So that's why I think when we got to the finish line Friday at noon, there were 37 trades. Never, ever seen that before.
Really incredible indeed. So the Dodgers making the big splash, and you're based in San Diego. Let's just talk on what they were able to do. And you said, yeah, the bidding war and everything else, but it was the Dodgers that got it done. They add Max Scherzer, Trey Turner. My goodness, these guys are defending World Series champions. They win the division every year. They're still looking up at the San Francisco Giants, but Lee, with 60 games left to go, I mean, clearly, does this make the Dodgers now again prohibitive favorites? I mean, you talk about impact players at a trade deadline.
Well, I think from the Dodger perspective, there's lots of angles to what they did. I think the acquisition of Scherzer and Trey Turner, plus the Kansas City pitcher, Danny Duffy, came at a really steep price. The Dodgers' payroll as of breakfast this morning is $262 million. That is $52 million above the luxury threshold. And because the Dodgers are a repeat offender in the luxury tax department, the Dodgers are going to have to pay a 42% tax on the overage, 42% of the $52 million that they are over the luxury tax. So you put pencil to paper and tell me what that figure is. So the amount of money going out the door is amazing. I do believe that they're going to get a deal done to keep Scherzer. They have a good relationship with Scott Boros, the super agent. Scherzer elected to go to Dodgers rather than somewhere else in a deal. And the Dodgers traded their top two minor league players as part of the four-man contingent that went to the Washington Nationals. I think the other intangible to keep an eye on is that the Dodgers, I think, are going to go to war with the union to extract themselves from the $103 million that they owe Trevor Bauer, who's in his third week of administrative leave for the sexual misconduct issues with the assault on that San Diego woman that happened back in the spring. I don't think he'll ever play again for the Dodgers. I think it's going to be an ugly civil war with the union over years 2 and 3 of his contract. But I think the Scherzer acquisition replaces Trevor Bauer salary-wise and roster-wise going forward. San Diego is up in arms. The fans really felt, based on everything that was happening on social media from the Baseball Insiders, the Padre-Washington deal to rent Max Scherzer was a done deal. But as I was told Friday night, the Padres had made their what they thought was a final offer that Washington would accept about, I want to say, noontime Friday, and did not hear from Washington for 5 hours. And the theory is that Washington took the Padre offer and shopped it to the Giants, shopped it, obviously, to the Dodgers. They had conversations with the Angels and the Red Sox at the last minute got in on the deal. Padres are furious because they thought they had a deal made. There was no deal signed and sealed, according to Mike Rizzo. I guess he's got every right to take someone's offer and shop it somewhere else, and he got a much better deal from the Dodgers. And I think the Padre deal would have been only a rental because the Padres are stretched financially. I mean, their payroll is now, I want to say, at $170 million. They've never been this high. They could have never, ever taken on Scherzer on a long-term contract. And the Padres have a bunch of problems with a pitching staff that's running out of gas and has got injury problems, et cetera. So the Dodgers made the deal at the last minute. The Dodgers have the resources and the assets to make that kind of deal. And lost in all the equation is the Giants getting Chris Bryant from the Cubs. And I don't think that's going to be a short-term rental. I think they'll sign him to a contract extension. They tried to get other pitching in addition to Scherzer, but we're not willing to rip the farm system apart. But so, yeah, the Dodgers, Giants, and to a degree the Padres, who did make three different deals, they were all players here as that Friday deadline came and went.
Interesting indeed. And now, of course, Fernando Tatis Jr. On the 10-day IL with the left shoulder injury, and he's already hurt it this season. And that's just got to be, you know, further insult to injury, Lee, in terms of the last couple of days for the Padres and how difficult it is to hang in there. Now, fortunately for them, you know, the wild card is still, they've got a lot of distance ahead of anybody in the wild card chase. But to try to win that division with the Dodgers improving and the Giants, we talked about them last week when you were on with us, is just nobody can figure out how they're still winning games, but they're still winning games. So not a good weekend for the Padres.
Well, the Giants are winning games because they really got a bunch of grinders, and their pitching has far exceeded what anybody thought would happen. So, I mean, the Giants have earned these victories. We're not taking this away. And now they add Chris Bryant's bat, you know, around Buster Posey and around Brandon Belt and around Brandon Crawford. So, I mean, the Giants are going to be a force unless they have injuries in the final 60 games. I think the Giants are going to be right there. The intangible thing with the Dodgers is not only the addition of the guys we just talked about in the trades, but Mookie Betts has been hurt for half the season. Corey Seager's been gone. They just got him back yesterday with a broken hand. They've had all kinds of problems with Cody Bellinger. He's a shell of the player he was a year and a half ago. He's never, ever been the same. He's hitting 167. And Dodgers have just got a lot of guys hurt, and now they're starting to get those guys back, and we'll see if it comes together. And by the way, you add a 328 hitter and Trey Turner into the middle of that batting order. So, you know, the Dodgers are the ones that scare me. And the Padres' big problem, I mean, their pitching staff has run out of gas. They have enormous injuries in their pitching staff, and now they lose Tatis. And I think this is going to be season-ending because this is the third time he's had this dislocation of the shoulder. And sports medicine people tell me that once you injure it, and then you injure it a second time, then the third and fourth and fifth times are going to happen a lot quickly and could have even further damage, not just to the torn labrum that's in there, but now there's fear if he does it again, he's going to tear the cartilage. If he has surgery next week, and I think he should go in that direction, the rehab is 6 months. If he tries to come back and play more, he could re-injure it again, maybe re-injure it worse, and if he has surgery at the end of the season, that's 6 months, which pushes him back into next spring and the start of the season. The kid is aggressive. The kid is, I'm not going to say he's reckless because that's being very unfair to him, but I mean, he just plays on the edge. But because he's got what now appears to be a chronic shoulder dislocation crisis, and he's only 22 years of age, I just think that the Padres are foolhardy if they try to put him back on the field after this 10-day stay on the DL, because it's going to happen again. He's had three dislocations and two other incidents. It's five incidents with a left shoulder since spring. What are we doing here with a superstar who's got so much in front of him?
Oh, there's no doubt. You don't want to wreck his career here for a wild card run this year, so we'll keep an eye on that. I'm curious your thoughts on, can the Oakland A's kind of keep pace? Because obviously, you know, Lee, the Blue Jays made some significant moves, as did the Yankees, to try to close the gap between the A's and the Mariners. Your thoughts on Oakland's ability to keep that wild card spot here? Because we already talked about the Yankees, but the Blue Jays making their addition, the Mariners doing what they could. This is going to be tight down the stretch.
Well, the A's kind of stepped out of character. I was a little bit surprised by what they did because David Forst and Billy Beane wound up acquiring four different players wrapped around the trading deadline. I mean, these guys are rentals, but Starling Marte is a good time player. And you put him, you know, you put him around Matt Chapman and Matt Olson, and you say, wow, that's a pretty good baseball team all of a sudden in terms of the power production standpoint. But they got Josh Harrison as insurance policy. They got a couple of other players along the way. So, and Oakland's got a bunch of young pitchers we don't pay very much attention to. But they are where they are in the standings because their young pitchers have done really well, led by this kid James Kaprielian, a former first-round draft pick of the Yankees. And he just got hurt the other night, and he's gone on the DL for 10 days, but he'll be back very quickly. But no, Oakland, like I said, Oakland added four players, and that's not normally the way they do business to rent guys right at the end. But Marte is going to be an on-base guy, a power guy, and he's going to be a nice complement to what is a pretty good group of bashers in that Oakland batting order.
Lee, a team that I'm fascinated with and is the Chicago Cubs. And of course, it wasn't that long ago, just a couple of years ago, that they finally broke through. They had that great young core, won the World Series, and everyone thought this is a team that's going to be good, so good for so long. And end of the day, Rizzo, Bryant, Baez, I mean, every team goes through ebbs and cycles, but boy, the way the Cubs have operated and what they've done in the last couple of years and only having that one World Series to dine on. And mind you, a World Series tastes pretty good. It doesn't matter. I'm not criticizing. But is there really a sense of disappointment that the Cubs could not maximize that young talent a little bit, at least more?
I think the correct word is anger. That's what the emotion should be in Wrigleyville right now. Two things. They got rid of nine players, virtually all the guys that were the core players from the three good years that they had. I don't understand Chicago's big money market. Chicago prints dollar bills in the hallways at Wrigley Field. And you're trimming your budget back and getting rid of all these guys and not negotiating to try to keep cornerstone players like Bryant and like Rizzo. So that there's a big philosophical divide right now about why they did what they did and why are you going to do this and think you can fix this thing going forward? Yes, they got a ton of young guys, but those are young guys. Those are players at AA and AAA. They're not going to be at Wrigley Field, I don't think, very much on opening day. I think the other piece of the equation, the Cubs got really good maybe 7 years ago when they invested heavily in the international market. And they got real good with the draft because they kept drafting high for that whole group of years. And then they hit the jackpot on an Anthony Rizzo trade. And all of a sudden, here came Baez and here came Chris Bryant through the draft. And here came Rizzo in that trade from San Diego. And at the end of the day, they stopped developing players after they got there. They got to the top of the mountain. Well, you still, no matter how good you are yesterday, you still got to build for tomorrow. And they didn't do it. They didn't draft well. They didn't acquire any other free agents. Their farm system has kind of fallen apart. So while you're celebrating the Cubs getting rid of the streak of the Billy Goat, I mean, the reality is they weren't doing the things behind the scenes that you need to do to make a winner going forward. I mean, look at your Blue Jays. Where would they be if there were no Vlad Guerrero, if there were no Bichette? So I think the Cubs philosophically, and I don't know if this is an ownership thing or just mistakes made by Theo Epstein, or for something's gone amiss there in terms of their blueprint as to how they operate the franchise, what they should have done. So if I were in the 312 area code, I think I'd be pretty angry right now about what Cubs baseball's been allowed to turn into, whether it's the owner doing this or whether it's Epstein and Jed Hoyer. But, boy, I don't like where this thing is right now compared to how they built it and got it to the point it did, and then they let it go downhill.
Yeah, there's no doubt. They are a fascinating study in how not to keep your team together. Lee Hacksaw Hamilton's great website is leehacksawhamilton.com. Check it out. Joins us on a regular basis on Sportsnet Today to talk some baseball and NFL as well. Always fun, Hacksaw. You stay well, my friend.
Good, Raj. We'll chat with you again. Be well. Thank you.
Thank you. Lee Hacksaw Hamilton joining us from San Diego. I'm Roger Lajoie. 37 major deals at the trade deadline. Craziness. Blue Jays benefit. We'll see if it's enough to get them into the playoffs. On Twitter at the Raj 590, majority of you say, yes, they are now good enough to be a playoff team. Here's some text to catch up there at 590. Mike says they have games in hand and made great pickups. Mike, thank you. Colin in Burlington says, Biggio will not be getting a contract. He'll go through the arbitration process if he's not traded. Colin, thank you. Likely that's a scenario I was referring to earlier, that the challenge the Blue Jays are going to have is to keep Vladdy Jr. and Bichette happy and major big deals in the same way Atlanta and San Diego had to lock up their great young talent. So when you look at the big picture and how much money you're going to be spending, you've got to be budgeting when their contract time comes up, roll up the Brinks truck. And Biggio's case is not quite the same as them, and that's a fair point. Henry in Mississauga says, even listening to the radio on Friday night made me feel good about things getting back to normal. Henry, thank you, and you are right. Ben Wagner did a fantastic job, as he always does, Friday and Saturday as well. Patrick in Saskatoon says, I agree with you, Raj. If they take advantage of the schedule they have coming up and possibly steal a couple of wins from the Bo Sox and the Rays and the White Sox, bringing momentum from stringing some series together against lesser teams, they have a very good chance of making a big push. Patrick, thank you. I'm not a subscriber into these sites that say probability of making the playoffs. I'm not. It's based on past performance. It's a different team. It's a trade deadline. It's an indication of somewhat, but I don't care if it's 38%, 33%, whatever it is they're saying, it's fully in their hands. It is. It's not a lot of teams. It's Oakland, Seattle, and the Yankees. And the Blue Jays are as good as any of those teams and are going to be better in the last 60 games. And while, yeah, August 1 is relatively late in the season, and to make up eight games on Tampa Bay with 60 to play, that you better go on a roll. Same thing with the Red Sox. But I don't think there's any doubt this team is right there. So, Patrick, thank you. Thanks for all the texts. 590-590 is our text for all our shows. Daniel, regular listener, listens in from Australia. And Daniel, thank you, and says, good day, Roger, from Melbourne, Australia. It's 2 a.m. I'm listening to your show as I wait for the game to start. I love the new additions, and I like our chances. But even if we don't make it, the games will be very exciting. Sorry to see Saucedo and Hatch go, but that just shows how deep our pen is now. Daniel, thank you so much. Always great to hear from you, and you stay well, sir. Brian says, I've raised my prediction from opening day of 85 wins to 96 wins. And Brian says, loves the additions recently of Simber, Dickerson, he's being forgotten, will be a great addition. And Richards all the way down, capping it off with a starter. I gave him, he was on my list of players to require. Having him and the others in the rotation is not only great for this year, but the 2020 rotation now with the big three is a great start. And his offseason wish is to call down to Cleveland for Ramirez at third. Brian, thank you. There is no doubt that the Blue Jays are going to be in a very envious position by the start of next season in a lot of ways. And they are in an envious position now, even though they're 3.5 back of a wild card. But 3.5 back of a wild card with 60 to play, you get a team on a roll, that's basically nothing. There is plenty of time for this Blue Jay team to catch, and we'll see if they can do it. Most of you agree. Our poll is 65.3%. Yes, the Blue Jays make the playoffs. 34.7%. They don't make the playoffs. Appreciate your feedback on Twitter, text, and on email. I'm Roger Lajoie. We'll get our thoughts for our producer, Kyle Norris, and we'll read more of your thoughts, and we'll get you ready for Blue Jay baseball because they finish up this coming home stand against Kansas City. First pitch, Ben Wagner with the call just after 1 o'clock. It's Sportsnet Today. I'm Roger Lajoie on the Sportsnet Radio Network.